We're in session. Approval of the agenda.
Move we approve the agenda as published.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
With your update, I assume that's it, isn't it?
Well, I got a couple other things.
Okay. We'll let you take some time.
I don't think we're going to be here long this afternoon. There's just... Let me update you on just a couple of things.
Yeah.
First of all, spring fishing is phenomenal right now. Anybody not fishing is missing out on a pretty great recreational opportunity. The ice is off all the reservoirs. Strawberry, I understand it went off Strawberry at the earliest ever. A lot of the waters around the state are just red hot fishing right now. Lake Powell in particular is, is on our website, but we have good, red hot. We're in the phenomenal category at Lake Powell. So I just want to report that spring fishing is good. It's been a dry winter, but our reservoirs are mostly full.
Why is it such good fishing?
The water warmed up quick, and the reservoirs are full, and lots of fish there to be had. You know, we planted a record number of fish the last couple of years, and it's just the availability and the timing, it's just really good. I wanted to update you a little on the coyote program. The public's getting pretty anxious, and I just wanted to tell you about our timetable on it, so if you get questions, you can tell people. We are planning on having our program finalized this month, and we're going to hold 3 open houses around the state to roll it out, to talk to interested hunters and trappers of how it might work. So we've scheduled 3 open houses, the 29th, 30th, and 31st, and we kind of tried to make it where nobody had to drive more than about 2 hours, so we're going to have 1 in Cedar, 1 in Price, and 1 in Salt Lake. Anybody interested in coming and talking to our people about the program? We'll have the details of the program worked out by then. We've made some progress on that so far. We think it's going to be fairly simple and easy for people to participate and right areas and the right time of year, and about ready to go with this thing. So I just wanted you to know, anybody that asks, by the end of this month, we're going to be want to get some public input before we finalize it. That's the reason for the 3 open.
Those days, this is the 29th in Cedar.
Right now we're scheduled the 29th in Cedar, the 30th in Price, and the 31st here in Salt Lake.
So those locations will be on your website?
Yeah. Yeah, and we'll work through the Trapping Association and others to let people know when and where they can come and talk about it. And they'll just be, it's not going to be like a rack meeting where we make a presentation and take public comment. We're going to have people there that can meet one-on-one and talk about it, and we'll have some information. And just we've been doing this with big game and fishing. Yeah, we've been doing these, you know, for big game and fishing, and they've been really popular with the public, where they can come and just casually talk rather than make a formal presentation.
People that want information.
Will these be announced at the RAC meetings next week?
We could. We can announce the days. I guess we've got the places finalized.
I think so. I think by next week I'll be on that RAC tour, and so I think that's a good idea, Mike. I can make sure that the RAC members are aware, have the regional supervisors in their updates, make people aware. So.
mention one more thing, and then I'll answer any questions you might have. This is shaping up to be a pretty serious fire year and a possible drought year, and those always present challenges for wildlife. We've already had a number of fires around the state. There's enough residual grass from last year that I know our forestry and fire people are pretty nervous about what this is shaping up. But we're watching that real closely. We're also probably going to be into a drought situation, and water supplies are going to get short fairly quick. I know farmers are already calling for water 100 miles an hour way early. So the water is going to get used up pretty quick, and then we're going to be possibly looking at shortages. That could all change with a nice wet spring, but we'll see. Oh, this is one of those average situations. We're making up for last year's abundant moisture. That's really all I had to tell you. That's all I could think of that going on. But since our last meeting at the end of March, if you've got some specific questions.
Any update on?
Oh, yeah, Kevin, you want to talk about
that? Determine it was a hybrid?
Good question.
I keep telling everybody they're hybrids. Guys, they're hybrids. There's no straight pure wolves. They're all hybrids.
But we still can't answer that definitively yet. Our folks in the central region are out at least twice a week, and the Wildlife Services folks as well. We have had one of our employees see one of the animals, again, obviously not a coyote. We've got pictures on a trail cam of a carcass we put out. We did get the DNA back from the scat that we collected from UCLA. It did come back as coyote. It did. We got those results back just recently. Although we've kind of had bits and pieces of information still coming in, nothing to the point where we feel like we have the animals localized to where Wildlife Services feels like it's worth putting any equipment out yet to put traps out so we can put radio collars on. But that's what we're moving towards. As soon as we can get actionable information, that's still our intention is to trap and put radio collars on, take all the blood samples and everything we need to at that time, put radio collars on so that when we do get the results back from a sample that we know is from the animals that we're interested in, with the radio collar on, if it comes back as a hybrid, then we'll know where to go find them. And if it comes back as a wolf, we'll know we'll be able to keep track of them. So it helps in regardless of what the results are in that case. So, we're spending a lot of time on it, and it's kind of a needle in the haystack kind of a deal in a way. But we feel like we're starting to zero in on it. We're working very closely with the Wildlife Services folks so that when we do get to where we think we can do something, everybody's ready to go. So
where they're protected and where they're not, up in northeast, east of I-84.
Yeah, if you take I-84 there at Snowville and bring I-84 down to where it meets I-15, and then I-15 down to where 84 leaves again up Weber Canyon, and then from the top of Weber Canyon up I-80 to Evanston. So everything east and north of that line, they're delisted. Everything, they're delisted. So we have management authority. The state does. They're no longer protected under the.
The rest of the state is not.
The rest of the state, they're still protected under the Endangered Species Act. Because that's a million-dollar question, Calvin.
That's where they drew the line.
That's where they drew the line.
The wolves are actually protected in the entire lower 48 unless delisted. So we've had the Northern Rockies delisted and the Great Lakes. They're working on the Mexican wolf thing. Theoretically, then the rest of the country will be delisted. But right now, the whole lower 48, other than those delisted
areas.
And
that includes places where wolves never existed.
Yeah. Is that corner part of the Idaho delisting?
Then? Yes, it's attached to the Northern Rockies, so Idaho and Wyoming. And Wyoming's close. Maybe Jim knows more.
Wyoming's working on it, but I don't think it's.
There is a plan that both Wyoming and the Fish and Wildlife Services have agreed upon. Now it's working its way through the process. Last I heard, it wasn't completed though yet.
Oh, and when it's done, it'll probably get a legal challenge. So
yeah,
they've got a ways to go. But
it's done as in we've reached an agreement. It's not done as in we've worked through the legal
right.
Okay. Kevin, when you if you catch an animal or animals there in the Spanish Fork Canyon area, wherever that is, and you collar them, what's your relationships there with the Fish and Wildlife Service? How do you work that? Are they part of this too? Are they wanting these animals collared?
We have a permit that allows us to capture and collar and release, and we're everything's lined up that way so that we're ready to go. Both our people are named by name on the permit, as are the Wildlife Services folks that are working on it. We've been in contact with Mike Jimenez out of Wyoming, who is the wolf recovery coordinator. He's fully apprised of what's going on. We're just waiting for the right opportunity to actually get him in hand.
And if it's confirmed that it's a wolf, then you go into further negotiations with Fish and Wildlife Service as to what you'll do with it, whether they will take it or whether you'll just
unwild. What they've told us is they don't intend to do much if they are wolves. They will remove animals if they reach a threshold on livestock damage, but the threshold they've set is fairly high, and there's some frustration with that. So we've been working on trying to get wolves under our authority for 10 years now, close to Jim, and we're continuing. And we've had everybody involved, from the governor to the Secretary of the Interior to our congressional delegation. And actually recently we've gotten more response than we have in the past, but there's still a long ways to go. Is that fair, Jim?
And then just finally, you might mention where we're at with Mexican wolves.
So there's a recovery team put together for the Mexican wolves. Myself and John Shivick are both on that recovery team. We're working very hard to make sure that they're not trying to recover that animal outside of its historic range. There's a meeting next month when kind of all this will come to a head in a way within the recovery team. And I'll know a lot more after about the middle of June. I think we're down there the 6th, 7th, and 8th or something like that of June. But it's there are some people on that group that are trying to move recovery of Mexican wolves north, and we're resisting that. Colorado's resisting that. Actually, Arizona, New Mexico, their game departments are completely behind us in resisting any efforts to do that. But it remains to be seen whether we're successful or not. So
now, Kevin. Oh, sorry. I was going to say, I've heard there is quite a push that to expand that, not just in their historic range, but if some people have their way, that could take in their recovery area, could take in quite a chunk of Utah.
There are some that feel that way. I honestly don't think it's going to go that way, John. If you asked me 6 months ago, I had more concern than I do right now. But the historic range of the Mexican wolf only came about halfway through New Mexico and Arizona, let alone approaching Utah and Colorado. So,
fair question. As a rancher, what a wolf? A wolf hybrid. What can I do if it's out in amongst my animals? Because I get people asking me that. Hey, if he's chasing my animals, if he's harassing them, I know what I'm going to do.
Yeah, legally, it's very limited, Calvin. Legally, right now, all you can do is call the Fish and Wildlife Service.
Depends on where you're at.
Depends on where you're at. But
if you're in that northeast corner, then it's delisted. Then
right.
You have
right.
Different...
Where you're under our state plan, if an animal's in the act of harassing, or you have confirmed depredation within, I think it's 72 hours. It's like our bear and cougar rule. The landowner or the owner of the livestock has a right to remove that animal lethally. But in the rest of
the state where it's protected, the only thing I can do is pick up the phone and call you.
Call the fish. And I can't even do anything but put you to the Fish and Wildlife Service. I can be a go-between, and we'll be glad to serve that role. But we don't have any decision-making authority.
It has to be with the national guys.
Has to be with
the
Fish and Wildlife Service. Yep.
There is a good page on the division's website that talks specifically about what landowners can do. Yeah.
Maybe I'll go get you some copies of that. You probably, if you're getting asked that question, Calvin, you probably ought to have a stack of them to hand out. because I'm sure in your position that's probably a question you get asked fairly often. So I'll make sure you have a bunch of those before you leave.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
Other question. Since you're a biologist sighting in Spanish Fork Canyon, have there been any credible sightings, kills, or howlings reported?
No, that one sighting included both a response to a howl and a visual sighting from several hundred yards away. And we did put a carcass out that we put there and a camera on it. We've since gotten a picture of a single animal. And it's interesting, there's pictures of coyotes and whatever else is out there, and it's obvious that there's a difference between the pictures of the two animals.
Interesting picture. It's clearly not a coyote, but it's not very big for a wolf either.
Yeah, it's. I'm still not. I'm not convinced of what we have out there.
Since then, no other sightings. Kills with
the pictures with the cameras were just taken middle of last week. Probably we got them, so it's within a week.
That was
in the Sheep Creek area.
An animal that you baited out there. Was it do you use wildlife? Do you use deer or elk, or what do you use to bait?
We put a deer carcass out.
Put a deer carcass out.
Yeah. Okay. So Sheep Creek comes up out of Spanish Fork Canyon.
And that's the area, and that's what I've heard from Sheep Creek to Dairy Fork in that general area.
Yeah.
Everybody's seen one. Everybody's seen the tracks. They've seen this, that, and the other. You get all kinds of stories.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And I've heard there's been some moose kills up there and a lot of tracks, and I think that's where they came back with the scat. And you're saying that was a coyote?
That came back as coyote. And when it's been sitting there for a long time and kind of gone through the freeze and thaw cycle.
You never know how long it's been.
Yeah.
It's hard to tell.
And it starts to look larger than you would expect with a coyote. But, we collected what we had there and sent it off, and that's the result that came back.
And it came back as a coyote.
Wolves are something that we aren't going to be done dealing with anytime soon. It's an issue that's going to remain for probably another decade, I would guess, just because of how politically charged it is and how slowly the courts work, and it's going to end up in the courts regardless of what happens. So
last question for Jim: any personnel changes that are announceable?
For the Southern Region Supervisor, made a decision, but we're still probably a day or two away from announcing it. We'll send you an email. Can't think of any other key ones. We had three people that we interviewed internally.
We actually interviewed the same day for the Private Lands Public Wildlife Coordinator, and we're about in the same place. We're close to making a decision, and then it becomes a process of an offer and everything else. So certainly by first of next week and probably sooner on that one.
Waterfowl coordinator.
We did hire a waterfowl coordinator about a month ago. Blair Stringham from the Southern Region is our new waterfowl coordinator. So. Formerly of the Southern Region, I guess I should say.
No new announcements on a new director or any?
Gonna fire me first.
Just asking. So I'm asking, is there any announcement?
No, not right at the moment. I can tell you two things. I am going to retire someday, and every day I get a day closer to it.
Jim.
There's not a lot of change. We're still involved in a number of meetings. The Public Lands Office, extension of the Governor's Office, is taking the lead on that now, and there's a large committee getting together to work on a state plan for sage-grouse. But they continue to meet, big meeting tomorrow again. Nothing really new to report. They're making progress, they say. Alan is our person on the committee, and then Jason is on the technical committee We also have Gary Ogborn, our GIS person, doing a lot of technical work for the committee. But nothing to report right now.
Okay. Where are those, Ern?
We can get you the dates.
I'd like to know when they are.
What the meetings were.
It's not here. No, I don't think it's in Logan.
In Logan right now is our annual coordination meeting with the co-op unit that's going on today and tomorrow. That's why Alan, or actually today, that's why Alan's not here right now. I believe that tomorrow's meeting is probably up at the Capitol with Sagegrouse would be my guess, but I don't know for sure. So,
just a couple other endangered species things. We got word that boreal toad is now in the 90-day review process. Is that right? How that works, Kevin? I know you don't know anything about toads, but you do know about the 90-day review process.
If they've started the... So there's a 90-day decision is the first decision that has to come, and then there's a 12-month decision. The 90-day is just a determination of whether it's worth looking into it farther. A lot of them get dismissed after 90 days. If there's enough concern or enough evidence that there's a need to go on, then you do have a 12-month finding, and that's when you have warranted or not warranted is after a 12-month.
And the other one hanging out there, we should hear about Gunnison sage grouse any day that lives in San Juan County, and we're going to hear about Mexican wolves before the end of the year. So.
And the 90-day thing and the 12-month thing are in name only. 90 days almost often takes 6 months, and the 12-month finding often takes 2 years. So.
Just kidding about 90 days. Any other questions? Jake?
Just a question on our agenda items. With them, as many as we had at this meeting, there's some of those, and I know before we've tried to lump more together, but our meeting in Beaver was really, really, really long. Some of those agenda items didn't get the attention I think they needed at the end because the public had left. So I don't know whether you want to discuss it now or part of with the niche or whatever, but is there some of those that we could put a month earlier or move them up a month earlier or next year? Or what's your take there?
Oh, there's some things, you know, that I don't know. You know, we've got nearly all big game stuff at this meeting tomorrow. I don't know how you split that up. We try and accommodate people so they don't have to come to a couple of big game meetings.
Before, we haven't had, well, I don't know how long ago, but it seems to me like we never had the antlerless with
right.
the big game before.
Right, and we did that purposely so that we could handle it all at once and people wouldn't have to attend a couple of different meetings. We weren't getting much. People weren't coming back to the antlerless meetings much after the Bucks and Bulls, so... We've combined those. I mean, we could split them back out, but I think we've done that one or two cycles.
And the antlerless seems to bring as much hate and discontent, if I will, as any of it. But we lost those people in Beaver the other night because the meeting was so long.
Yeah.
I mean,
well, something to think about. We've got time.
When that came up, why, those people were gone.
What it would mean is doing the Bucks and Bulls stuff earlier because we can't do the antlerless earlier. And then we get backed up against tooth data and postseason deer classification and all of that. The biggest gap in our system is we really go overboard at the division to be customer friendly. And we build a lot of time to our system to help people that are in the application process. And if we weren't so customer-friendly, we could shorten it way up. But people, I think, like the fact that we're so customer-friendly, but so it drags our process out a little. We're really releasing information about the same time as other states, trying, but I don't know. We could split up antlerless and big game again. It's a lot to do that many more rack meetings and board meetings and stuff. But.
Add another board meeting and rack meeting.
Yeah, I'd
really up to the board.
I'd point out that that was a very conscious decision to try and combine those. After years of watching the manpower drain on the biologists and everybody else to do them separately by a little bit, and the process that we're using now is the process that the division used years and years ago before it was split apart. I also noted that other than the Southern Rack, the other meetings weren't all that bad time-wise. Northern region was 3 hours, and about the Northeast and the Southeast
weren't too bad. That South was, it was a...
And maybe the Salt Lake guys learned something after going through the Southern region and made the other regions work better, and that'll carry forward to next year. So I'd say let's give it a year or two, not just throw it out the first time because there was a problem.
Well, I'm not totally against what you're saying, Ernie. Maybe the only stipulation is next time when that comes around, let's keep as many other agenda items off there as we can.
Hey, Anise. If I also may, when we had them separate, we would always get questions about antlerless at the antlered because they wanted that data, and often that data wasn't available. And that was another one of the reasons we put them together, is so we can address both population level stuff and buck and bull level stuff at the same meeting. So I think it does make sense. I do agree when the meeting gets long, some of the stuff gets lost and people do lose interest at the end of the meeting. So
there's a learning process for the RAC members too. I noted in the Southern region stuff, there were guys trying to jump in with population stuff when we were talking bucks and bulls and vice versa. And I'm sure they learned a lesson that they'll remember next year and keep the topics better divided.
And perhaps in the future we could switch them up, do the antlers first and then do bucks and bulls second. If, if people are more likely to stay for the bucks and bulls, they may.
I think people will stay for the antlered stuff.
Right.
Why bull riding is always your last event in the rodeo.
There you go. Keeps their attention.
Yeah. Now, let me point out another one. When I started this stuff, 14 years ago, we used to stay till midnight for cougar meetings and bear meetings. And, God, it's so much better now than it used to be.
Yeah, our meetings are actually way shorter. The big game permit number meeting regularly went 7, 8 in the evening.
Okay. Nothing else. I want to move on. View of RAC agenda items. Anise, you got the floor.
Yeah, I guess I'm just here to answer any questions you may have about what went on in the RACs. You know, I've got the, I'm assuming you have the summary of motions. If you have any things you want clarified, I'm just basically here to, clarify anything or answer any questions you may have. I don't have anything prepared, so I just...
Do we want to go through those RAC motions? The division, we feel like we can accommodate some of those RAC motions. Others, we think we're just going to let our recommendations stand. But I think it would be worthwhile to go through each of those RAC motions and let Anise talk about how we feel about them.
Let's do that.
That's okay with you. I think that's really the value of this meeting is to.
Yeah, I'm happy to hear that.
So with that, Anise, I'm just going to start there on that summary of motions and start with the southern region. It's
sure.
The top of the page, and the first one that I have underlined is that 20 to 25, those four units. If you want to give us the board an
sure.
update.
From that one was one of the motions that came out of the southern region, and basically they felt there were a few units that were already above 20, and they wanted to keep them there. And that was where that motion was trying to do. And basically, I do need to say that there's four units that fell into that. And those units are above object or above 20 for different reasons depending on the unit. So I guess I didn't, it's probably not a recommendation we could go behind be able to go along with, just because they are different because of different reasons. And if we do add that third tier, there is the potential for other units in other parts of the state wanting to be in that, and then that would lose a lot more opportunity. If you're trying to manage for 20 to 25, you're pretty close to limited entry, and you really start to reduce permits quite a bit. Now, having said that, these units are a little bit above 20, some quite a bit above 20, but for different reasons. So that, like, the Oak Creek is partially limited entry. So that's the reason why that one is. So obviously we didn't raise permits on that because we knew that the objective would be high. Similarly, the Thousand Lakes just came out of limited entry, and that's the reason that one is higher. So I think, on those two units, probably things aren't going to change a whole lot, even whether we go leave them 20 to 25 or leave them 18 to 20. I think we wouldn't issue more permits knowing that they couldn't support more permits given the populations and the limited entry factor. The Southwest Desert is one that's a little tricky. It's fairly sparsely populated with deer. So even if you put lots of hunters out there, success rates are probably not going to be very high. It's just not very productive area. And that's another one where we didn't add permits knowing that there's not a lot of areas to hunt out there. So these are all units that are above, but we didn't recommend adding permits either because of that. The only one where we did add a few permits is the Zion unit. We added, I think, 200 permits, and we realized that we could add more permits on that, but there's so much private land there that it would be saturated. So these are four units. Whether they go in any objective will likely have high buck doe ratios just because of the way you approach hunting them. And that's why we feel we should leave, the way we've recommended it the same. But when we recommend permits on these units, we take these things into consideration, and we don't just keep ramping up permits because they're above objective. We have to take all these other issues into consideration, and we have. So that's why I think that's a recommendation that the Southern Region felt they had to do just to make sure that permits weren't ramped up on these units. But I think as a division, we wouldn't recommend increasing permits that much on these units, regardless of where the buck-to-doe ratio is.
That would also be consistent with the northern region, where you've got four private land units that are up to 35 buck-to-doe ratios consistently.
Yeah, correct. And that's kind of where that falls in.
And yet there's no problem leaving them at 18 to 20 because they're still going to be 25 to 35 10 right. years from now. It's a question of landowners and access.
So I guess, that's a motion that I can understand where they were coming from when they made it. But really, if we go that route, it just opens up a whole other, category where you're almost to limited entry status. And I guess our preference would be if we're going to go that route, let's just make them limited entry and not try to be in the between range. Let's, keep general season where we provide opportunity. And if we want more limited entry units when we open up the statewide plan, we should, try to see if we want to put more limited entry units into that.
Right now, the recommendation is on those four units to do an 18 to 20?
Correct.
Is that correct?
Yeah.
But
that's the divisions.
That's the division's recommendation.
Correct.
Right.
Yeah.
And when you put permit numbers out there, it's not just a numbers game. We've got X number of deer, then we have a percentage of permits.
Mm-hmm.
Some you do, some you don't. You also take into other considerations. Yeah. Is that why you say it's not just a numbers game?
Exactly. It's based on a buck doe ratio, and buck doe ratios usually track population levels really well. So on these units, even though they're above buck doe ratio on a lot of them, we still did not recommend increasing permits greatly, except for a few permits on the Zion unit.
Right.
Now, Anise, I'm going to come up tomorrow, and I may ask you, you know, if we go something other than the DWR's recommendation, you going to be prepared to give us what that permit numbers would be based on that then?
You bet.
Okay.
Those particular regions down there, Calvin, a lot of those hunters over the last 4 or 5 years have sacrificed hunting days. Made that I can't remember the years in the East. Maybe you can help me. But the southern region was five-day hunting.
Right.
Two or three different times. And that's why, part of that reason is why we have that buck-to-doe ratio that we have there now. And they're just trying to protect, you know, what they've worked so hard to keep.
Protect what they've already got.
Yeah. Rather than.
Is that still going to be a five-day hunt?
No.
No, it isn't. That's a disagreement probably Jake and I have a lot of the southern region folks believe that the 5-day hunt has created a larger buck to doe ratio, but the data does not bear that out. I mean, looking at harvest success rates and numbers of deer harvested 5-day versus 9-day just doesn't show the difference in harvest success rates.
So another thing to point out, we already have an 18 to 20 mm-hmm. and we have a 25 to 35. So 20 to 25 overlaps.
Right.
It overlaps both general season and limited entry. And to try and squeeze in there another objective for, say, 21 to 23 or something, we're really getting down to micromanaging these units where it's not really necessary. I mean, we've made the adjustment. We've not, even though they're over 20, we didn't recommend additional hunters, except on the Zion where that's mostly a private land unit. And so there's really not a need for another category in there. And what we're doing now is having a continuum that would give us now five types of units with different buck doe ratios. And it's getting just a little bit.
And then if you open that up, then somebody from somewhere else, well, if that's in that area, then this area, I want that in there because I think it's.
That's where we're afraid of
protection.
Yeah, that's where we're afraid of.
Just kind of opens
it
up into more issues.
Yeah, exactly.
Anise, so, I mean, if we did do that, we'd be moving it. I mean, by the time you average it out, you'd move your objective up. If you're managing for 19 on an 18 to 20, you'd move it up 3 or 4 bucks per 100 does. I just want to make sure I understand you. The reason those permits are what they are on those units has a lot to do with other factors besides the buck to doe ratio. And no matter what buck to doe ratio is on those units, the permit numbers probably won't change a lot because of public land and access and issues like that. So regardless of what the ratio is and the objective, the permit numbers, there's not a lot of wiggle room. Either way.
Point is, if we'd had that objective, what would have been your recommendation?
Well, you know, probably the same as it is now, you know, because of other issues.
And that's what I'm at. So what you're saying, just to make sure we're on the same page, I understand you. Other limiting factors besides the objective are why these numbers are what they are.
Exactly, yeah. Okay. And we haven't recommended the number of permits required to bring that buck doe ratio down because we know those units can't hold that many hunters either because of crowding issues or you know, private land issues and things like that.
Okay. Let's move on to the next one, and that is the option of having your unsold permits rolled over from one category to another.
Yeah. And that one, as you know, we mentioned to you before, and it's basically a way to make sure permits that are unsold get sold somehow to avoid, you know, both revenue and opportunity being lost. And this is the southern region is the only region that voted against this recommendation. So, you know, I still think it's a good recommendation. I do see where people can be concerned that there's a little bit higher success rate on the rifle if they do roll into the rifle type. But as I mentioned before, and I explained it, it's a problem that will fix itself. If you do have a higher harvest, that will be, you'll see that in the buck-to-doe ratio, and you can adjust permits as needed. I don't see a lot of permits going into that far. But if they do, obviously we can change these things. We meet on an annual basis, and if we see that that is an issue, I think we can certainly address it the following year. I don't see that many permits going into the rifle and then us over-harvesting by a large amount the buck population.
It wasn't even much of a discussion in any of the other racks, was it?
I think they discussed it in a few racks. There was one motion that failed in one rack.
Can you identify what you think those regions will be or those units will be?
The units, I mean, we kind of have an idea which ones they will be. Most of them will be in the northern region, so likely the cache and the box elder would be ones, and maybe even some of those private land units will have some permits left over just because of access issues. So those are probably the ones that will be the largest ones. The units that have always been sought after are going to go in the drawing.
What
so
about
those,
like the Southwest Desert?
The Southwest Desert is likely. I don't know. I mean, that's one that may or may not, but I don't see it. It's one where, you know, there's a few hunters that like to hunt out there, so there's only 700 permits. I think those will all go in the drawing. It's not a large number of permits, so that one likely will all go in the drawing, I would think.
So these are rifle permits that go unsold or undrawn.
Let me explain. Archery. Maybe if for those of you that don't. So basically, the way we're going, we're going to have all weapon types go into the drawing on a 60-20-20 split. Now, there are likely some units where the archery or muzzleloader permits will go under prescribed through the drawing. So what will happen is once, there's archery permits remaining, they'll become over the counter for archery only until the archery season is over. But once the archery season is over, if there are permits still available, they become muzzleloader permits, and they're sold as muzzleloader permits. And then if there's even permits left after the muzzleloader season is over, then they become rifle permits. And that's kind of the recommendation that we made. Over the counter, all of that over the counter, yes. That's kind of our rationale for that one. I think it's worth at least rolling out 1 year, and if we see that there is substantial over harvest, it's something we can certainly do away with if we see that. I don't anticipate that happening, to be honest.
And part of this is that 60-20-20.
Right.
Refresh me again, because we're close to that right now, aren't we?
We're fairly close. Right now we probably have more of a, I bet if you did the percentages, it's probably more like 70 to 75% of rifle. And then about close to 20% is archery, but maybe a little below that, maybe 18%. And then the muzzleloaders, where we really bumped them up, it's probably more like 12 or 13% are muzzleloader hunters. So we just made it a more even split and put a little bit more of the permits into the more primitive weapons. That way we could increase permits slightly without harming the resource, still managing buck doe ratios where we need them.
I'm just speaking for myself. I feel like the rifle hunters are taking in the shorts. I mean, we got a short season now. And maybe I have a little bit of problem with the archers because they keep begging and begging, and we keep giving and giving.
Sure. Yeah, and overall, archers, they may have gotten a bigger split, but they're not gaining too many permits. But if more people are willing to go into archery to hunt, it is a less successful weapon type, and it gets people out in the field.
Sure.
So, and through our surveys, we've seen that the public in at large was willing to switch to, less or more primitive weapons to maintain opportunity.
Opportunity.
So.
Okay. Next one I'm going to bring up is in the southeast region. that Manti, San Rafael, and San Juan, bumping that up to 18 to 20?
Yeah. Yeah, so there was two units, the Manti, San Rafael combined unit, and the San Juan unit there. They wanted to bump up to the 18 to 20. You know, that's one that does worry us, because the region did quite a bit of outreach there, and at least the locals that they talked to there wanted the units to be in the lower, the 15 to 20 or 15 to 17, because they wanted more opportunity. They wanted to be able to hunt their backyard. Having said that, you know, if we had to choose, I guess we wouldn't mind the San Juan going to 18 to 20, but we really would not like to see the Manti go to 18 to 20, because you could likely lose 1,200 permits by just making that switch. So for opportunity's sake, you know, if I guess we had to split the baby on this one, we would rather the San Juan go the 18 to 20, but maintain the Manti at the 15 to 17.
I can tell you from personal experience, too, I managed both of those units for a long time. The San Juan unit has the capability of getting to 18 to 20, and it did for many years, and it just has that capability. The Manti, we always have struggled with buck-doe ratios. For many years, they were single digit.
Right.
And to get it up into 18-20, we would have to make an immediate cut this year of 1,200 permits. But I suspect it would have to be much deeper than that over time. And that's a unit that's close to the people, the hunters, the Wasatch Front that hunt the west side. And it's a unit that provides a lot of opportunity. It's a big unit. I hate to see us get too restrictive on that unit for the sake of a couple of bucks per 100 does. I'm confident that we would really struggle to get that up to 18 to 20.
Yeah, it's a fairly well-roaded unit with lots of public land.
You know, that's a unit, obviously, my hometown being right there. I get more calls on the Manti and the Wasatch, probably just because where I live, than any other units in the state. And, man, I have got blasted the last couple weeks about a couple things. First, that the central region doesn't have an 18 to 20. And the second, that the Manti we aren't doing things there to get the quality and the buck doe ratio up. And, I can understand, because I'm a little miffed too as to why we don't find a unit in the central region for 18 to 20. And then the Manti, and I can appreciate what Jim's saying, but boy, I'm just hearing a lot of people just concerned about the Manti and wanting to see that in the. First off, the number of bucks, you know, is a big concern, in the quality. Just a lot of people are up in arms that we aren't, that didn't make it into the 18 to 20. And like I said, I mean, I can agree with you that, you know, the opportunity, and it is close to the Wasatch Front. It is close to big population. But, I think that's one we're going to continue to hear about for a long time, because it's popular. It's surrounded by rural Utah. It's close to urban Utah, and it's just a lot of people are worried about that one.
I agree. I think there are a lot. But, you know, just keep in mind that at least when the region did their outreach in the region, and I've talked to Justin since then as well, you know, the majority of the public they talked to wanted more opportunity rather than restricted.
Are you talking at the open house? Is that what you're talking
to? Yeah, and they talk to the, you know, the local SFW guys, the local, you know, folks there. Obviously, I mean, if it's your backyard and it's 18 to 20 and you don't get to hunt it, you're going to be pretty upset. I could see the guys on the Wasatch Front wanting it more quality, because, you know, it's you know, for a lot of them, it's not their backyard. But, you know, you got to take both into consideration. And it being such a big unit, I mean, you know, you want to try to manage the units that make sense for opportunity to be opportunity, and the ones that make sense for.
So a couple questions on that, kind of going along with what you just said. In order to get it to 19. And because I mean, when we say 18 to 20, we're saying 19.
Right. Yeah. That's the target. That's we're the target. To hit. Yeah.
To get it to 19, we would have to cut. Well, the immediately cut this year. If we was to vote that in, we'd cut 1,200 permits 13, off.
1,300
permits off of the out of the draw this year. I mean, we know.
Right.
And Jim, you're saying you think that's not going to get us there?
I would be surprised if that got us there. I just, that unit's had low buck doe ratios for so long. I think you'd be in a downward spiral there of hunting opportunity. That's 10% of the hunting opportunity in the state, by the way, you're dealing with.
Didn't we cut quite a few tags of what we think was there last year and what's going to be there this year anyway? Didn't we make a pretty substantial cut
there? We did
cut
a little bit
there
in the southeast region, not as much as we did in some other regions. So, yeah, we're partway there. But this number here is taking those cuts into consideration and what cuts are further needed to get.
I guess it's possible that even with these numbers that we have here, if we do pass the numbers that you've proposed this year, there's a possibility we may have to even go deeper
to get it to the
16.
Yeah, certainly. And a lot of these are based on, you know, what populations are doing now or have done in the last few years. As we all know, you know, wildlife populations fluctuate, and with that, so do buck doe ratios. So, you know, we feel pretty comfortable about the numbers, but obviously things could change.
I mean, it's the first year of a new program.
Right.
So.
Exactly. And then we'll be watching it closely. But, yeah, I mean, it's a big unit with the, you know, a big part of the deer in the state. So if you do manage it for a higher buck doe ratio, you are going to be cutting a lot of opportunity. And that's one we worry about because it's centrally located. A lot of people put in for that unit.
But the San Juan, you think, has a lot more potential to make that mark.
Yeah, because it is.
It used to be 20 year in and year out.
Right, and it is connected to a limited entry unit, the San Juan Elk Ridge, which, you know, there's some.
What would our permit reduction be if we.
400.
400.
That'd be 400.
Isn't this last year's buck to doe ratio, isn't it right about 19 or something like that right now?
San Juan. Yeah, I think the 3-year average is 17, so yeah, it probably was about that this year.
So it kind of go on.
Manti was a little bit below 50, just below 50.
Yeah.
So it kind of, the San Juan would kind of go on the maintenance program, keep it where it's at, whereas the Manti,
you'd have to cut
major
it.
Surgery.
Yeah.
One of the things that I have heard, a couple of different things along the same line. One is that, well, if you bump those two units up to 15 or to 18 to 20, then the only unit in that whole entire region of the state that's 15 to 17 is the LaSalle's. Is
correct.
That right?
Yeah, that is correct.
So everything else, that whole southeast corner of the state is 18 to 20, with the one unit in LaSalle's being the only one.
Don, can I share? I know you've been hearing other people's anecdotal evidence. Let me share mine on the Manti, and it's me and Anise. We hunted there 2 years ago with five guys.
Now you sound like all the guys I'm talking
exactly.
to. I hunted there 3 years ago, and this is how it is. So go ahead.
So let me tell you what. I mean, just this is one person, but it was our experience. Five tags. We killed three mature bucks: 3.5-year-old, a 5.5-year-old, and a 7.5-year-old buck. And I missed and I missed the biggest buck of the group that we didn't bring home. You know, so that a 60, I know that's just five guys, and we hunted hard. We packed in, we took llamas and horses and everything. But, you know, based on my anecdotal evidence, Manti's in pretty good shape. And so I'm just, and the illustration is.
Oh, and
you know,
I understand.
There's a broad spectrum out there of people's experience. And it's the ones that maybe the 1 year have a bad experience, or the ones that you're going to hear from. I'm not going to call and complain about the Manti after that experience.
I understand. I got a phone call from a guy that told me one thing, and then 20 minutes later, his best friend called me and went off completely 180. And so, yeah, I know exactly what you're saying.
So on that unit specifically, it took a 14% cut to get to the 16, the 15 to 17. So it would take quite a bit.
So we already cut 14% from last year to this year. Okay.
Nice. How about jump back to the San Juan for a second?
Sure.
You're proposing 2,500 permits.
Correct.
I believe in 2008-2009, they had 2,500 and 2,600 hunters.
Right.
And the reason 2010 went down was that aberration of a five-day hunt.
Right.
Affected hunters and where they hunted all over the state.
Yeah.
So if you accept that that caused major shifts of hunters,
right,
then the division proposal is no different in the San Juan than what it has been,
yeah,
in past years.
So that's one, yeah, that's one that had some you know, anomalies to it, I guess. The biologist there realizes that in the past it's actually held a lot more hunters than it maybe did in the last little bit, or there was an influx of hunters because we had a shortened season on part of the La Salles, and people hunted there early and then hunted the San Juan late. So, yeah, we did take that into consideration, and that's why we modified it slightly from what the direct permits would have been if we just took the last 3 years.
Anise, what did didn't they hold an open house in San Juan County?
They did.
And what did the people say?
The people that came there wanted it 15 to 17. There was one person on the rack who was from that area that felt that the people that were there at the meeting, even though they were SFW reps and all these, did not represent him specifically. So that's kind of where the motion came from. He was the one who made the motion, and obviously it passed. But
And just one caution to the board, even though we felt like we could go along with 18 to 20, it wasn't that long ago then the locals in San Juan County were asking that we turn Elk Ridge back into a general season unit because they weren't getting enough opportunity. So you already have a limited entry hunt sitting there. But we feel like that unit has the ability to perform at the 18 to 20 level without a drastic reduction, so we can, since the RAC voted for it.
Anise, that there was Jim said something about an open house, but the meeting you talk about was held the night before the RAC meeting, right?
Well, I think both meetings, from talking to Justin, seemed to be that the local folks wanted it to be in the lower.
When they did the open house,
right,
there earlier,
yeah,
in the year.
That earlier in the year, okay. Yeah. In any case, that's kind of where we would be weighing in on that motion for changing those two units.
Okay, let me ask you one dumb question, and that is with that Manti San Rafael. It is a huge area.
Yeah.
To me, there's topography and precipitation is everything different between.
There is.
So doesn't it make some sense to stay west of that highway coming down through Castledale and call that the Manti?
Yeah, and that was one that we struggled with quite a bit, and Jim may be able to speak to that a little bit more. But we don't get enough classification on the San Rafael unit to manage it separately. And then landowners along that Highway 10 that have property on both sides,
right,
want to hunt one or the other, or both. So we decided because of that, because most of the deer that live on the San Rafael unit actually live close or in the fields, we decided we manage it with the Manti. Not very many deer on the San Rafael unit, even though it's a large area. We could just lump it together and use classification data from the Manti mostly to manage.
After you get a couple of miles from Highway 10, there's not hardly any deer.
Right.
So it didn't make sense for that to be a standalone unit. And he hit it right on the head. A lot of landowners own property both sides of that line, and they would have had to pick between one unit or the other. So it made sense to combine those.
Okay. And let me go to the next one. That's my area, the Northeast region, 18 to 20. They said 18 to 20 statewide, I think. The motion was a little bit out of place.
Yeah.
I think it was all directed primarily to the South Slope Vernal Unit.
Sure. Yeah, and I can understand them wanting that. That will be a very difficult unit, if you're familiar with it, to get to 18 to 20. So it probably wouldn't be one that we could get behind. I mean, we put a lot of units in that region to 18 to 20. That's the only exception. And as you know, that one's been at 10 and 11. And it would be a very difficult one to get to 18 to 20 and may take quite a big reduction to get there. Again, if that goes that way, it just means less opportunity for folks in that region, to hunt their backyard. I don't think they realize how big of a cut it would require to get there. And
talk about CWD and how that affects buck-doe ratio.
Yeah. So, you know, there's always people want to manage for bigger or higher buck-doe ratios, but, especially in CWD positive areas, the majority, the older bucks tend to have a higher prevalence of CWD. So you actually want fewer older bucks if you're trying to keep CWD from spreading faster. And that's why in a lot of areas we don't, where we have CWD, we don't try to grow a lot of older bucks just because it tends to spread the disease quicker because older bucks tend to have a higher prevalence of it. So
one of the reasons LaSalle's is 15 to 7.
Right, exactly.
Mr. Chairman, can I ask?
Sure.
On some of these units in these, where it takes quite a cut to get them to 16, that's still a, if we do make those cuts and we do get them to 16, that's still a marked improvement over, it, over where they are now. So people are seeing, on some of these units what they perceive to be, you know, to them, and
yeah,
it's not a very good hunt, not a very good opportunity when you do go hunting. But once we do get them from 13 or 14, we're up to 16, that's still a marked improvement from what they are now.
Sure.
And I think sometimes the, you know, the push to get them to 18 is, well, we need to take drastic measures, where even a 16 is still quite an improvement.
Yeah, and I would agree with you. I think people have a hard time perceiving what 16 is going to look like and what 18 is going to look like. So they always say, well, more is better, so let's have more. And then I do agree. I think if we get to 16 on some of these units, a lot the hunters are going to see a difference because of where they've been at 10 or 11.
Because we've never had a time where we've been at, even when we were managing for 15, never have we had a time where everything was at 15.
Right, exactly. And especially on the Vernal and the Monroe, those two units have always been right around 10, 11. And I think on those units, once we get to 16, I think the public will certainly be happy. There's always going to be those few that, you know, always want, you know, to harvest a mature, you know, large antlered buck. But, you know, I think on those units, even if we get to 16, we will be, a lot of the people will be, you know, just pleased.
Just a little long-term perspective. I passed this out a couple of years ago, but I just realized there's four new board members since then. I went back and looked at 82, 83. 82 is the year we had a record buck harvest in the state, over 80,000 bucks. What was our buck doe ratio? It was, and I'm just shooting from the hip here, but it was single digits. It was 8 or 9 in 82, 83, and then it was 12 the next year. Actually, those are vice versa. It was 12 in 82, and I think it was 8 or 9 in 83. So buck doe, and people want those days back. What they really want is to see as many deer as they saw.
And that's the thing. I mean, the underlying problem here is the population, sure, not the number of bucks. And I think we all, and I'm as guilty as anybody, I have to remind myself about that about every day, that what we need to do is grow more fawns, and then the bucks will come. But anyway.
Yeah, no, I agree.
Buck doe ratios are higher considerably now than they were in the 80s. And this is going to push them even higher than where we've been. So it's progress. It's in the right direction. And we're not going to have any outlier units. All units are going to have to perform. And so it's a major change for the better. So.
But the population is the key to this.
Yes, but the population is much lower. People aren't seeing as many deer. Doesn't feel that good if the buck doe ratio is 15, if there's only 15 bucks.
Yeah. So. We need fawns to survive is what
this
we need.
This is true,
so.
Yeah.
So how do we, this is the thing that's been nagging at me all this last week or so, how do we get that message out to the general public? You know, I listened to the meeting online. I wasn't able to attend the Southeast Region meeting, but I listened to it online, and I've read through the other minutes. And, you know, time and time again we go through this, and you'll hear someone stand up and say, we've got to save the deer herd. let's raise the buck-to-doe ratio.
Right.
And then you'll stand up and say, well, you know, really, the buck-to-doe ratio doesn't have that much to do with growing the deer herd. And 2 minutes later, somebody will stand up and say, we've got to raise these buck-to-doe ratios to save the deer herd.
Yeah.
And there's never anyone coming forward with any evidence to suggest that by increasing the buck-to-doe ratios that we're going to grow more deer.
Right.
And so, you know, that's frustrating to me that, you know, here we are, we're relying on the professionals, the biologists that are there and have been for many years, and they're not only relying on themselves, but you're relying on biologists who are looking at research or doing all these things from several other states. And yet we can't get folks to take a look at that objectively and say, maybe we ought to listen a little bit to that. That's frustrating to me, and I don't know.
You know, Mike, when I have people question me about that thing, I try and help them differentiate between, are you talking about bucks or are you talking about total deer? And after you talk about that for a while, you see that most people's concern is the lack of deer. Of course, they're concerned about buck-doe ratios. When it gets down into single digits, that doesn't look very good. But I think most people realize that the problem is a lack of deer, and that's what we're working on really hard. These buck-doe ratios are nice, but they're not producing any more fawns. 15 or 20 or 25 bucks doesn't produce a single more fawn.
And, you know, and just kind of going along with what's been said, but I think the population is obviously the key to deer hunting or whatever we have in general, but still the hunting part of it and the quality of the hunt is a huge part. It's a big part of it to me. It's a big part of it to the guys I go hunting with. And so the buck doe ratio, as much as it doesn't affect the overall population, it's still a very important part of what we do. A very important part. And the number of permits, although they may not affect the overall number of deer, still an incredibly important part of our job and your job as managers, and that's just sure. It's part of the job. And it is hard to keep those separate, but they're both, because it's all about deer.
It is.
And they all run together. But still, the buck-doe ratio and the quality of hunt, quality versus opportunity, you know, and all that comes down to perception. Quality is different things to different people, opportunities different things to different people. And I guess that's why we get the big bucks, Mike.
No, there's one other theme that came out multiple times this round of meetings that we need a whole bunch of public education on. That is the immediate leap from we didn't see as many X quality bucks or bulls this year as we have for past years, or the Boone and Crockett score went down. Therefore, we're over harvesting bucks or the bulls, and we need, or the deer, and we need to cut permits without realizing that there's multiple other factors that affect antler size and antler mass, like precipitation, like food, like a hard, bad winter going beforehand, like perhaps the amount of cover on the mountain the day the hunt occurred, which can vary drastically year to year. So you jump from a condition which may be true to an illusion which is got no basis in fact. But they keep going that one direction as the immediate fix for the problem that's observed.
Are you talking about deer or elk?
Both.
Because I'll argue with you on that with elk, that there's a direct link between the number of permits and the eventual overall quality
there
on
is.
A herd.
I don't disagree.
There are other factors, but that's a big factor. There are other factors, but that is a big factor.
I didn't see a 350 bull to we're over harvesting. You got to eliminate vegetation, forage, cover, and perhaps hard winter going in, miserable condition at the beginning of the year.
You know, we're going to get into elk.
I think we'll stick to deer because we'll talk about that.
Yeah.
I just want to say one thing about that, John. There's a difference between I agree with you that there's a link between permit numbers and age. The link between permit numbers and quality of antlers is not as clear-cut because the quality of antlers depends on much more than age. And we're managing for an age objective, and our ages are still way up there, and antler quality is not only dependent on age, it's dependent on nutrition and all kinds of factors that permit numbers do not control.
I'll argue with you guys in a little while when we're done with deer.
So, yeah, I guess to get to Mike's concern, I think we do have a lot of outreach and you know, education to do, Mike. We're trying to get there. It's a tough one because people do, you know, do want to link the two. Deer are deer, so if you're killing something, there's going to be fewer of it. And I still remember one RAC member in the Southern RAC actually saying that. I understand what you're saying, but I have a hard time, putting it together and actually recommending to it. So yeah, it's a lot. And I think the ag guys get it a lot quicker than maybe the non-ag guys when they know that you don't put too many bulls out because they're going to be eating the forage that your cows could be eating. You only put enough to service all the females. And but somebody who just is looking to see more deer and more bucks, they just don't understand that the relationship that you don't need that many to actually have a healthy population.
In your in the WAFA publication on deer management, which is a very good publication, by the way, I taught a class this last semester, and I had my class read that, and I was amazed at the comments that I got back on that publication. The course is a non-majors course. It's called Living with Wildlife, and it's a depth science course, so it's right. Like an upper division gen ed class, and so it's mostly non-majors, but 60 students in the class, and it was amazing to me the number of students that commented on that. They all liked the publication. They never realized that deer management was such a complex issue, but the interesting thing to me was the number of avid hunters that made that same comment. That publication does not address buck-to-doe ratios very well. So I was just curious, are there, in your WAFWA deer working group, you discuss these things, I'm sure, but is there any kind of a publication talking about deer management more specifically relative to harvest?
Which one did you use?
The fancy blue.
Okay. One. Yeah, there's actually a book that's called Mule Deer Management, I forget. I think most of the board members have it.
Is this the one that Utah State did?
Yeah, the Behrman Institute. And there's a chapter in there about harvest management, and there's a couple papers from White et al. From Colorado that looked at buck-doe ratios and how they affect fawn production. There's several papers in there that are quoted and a chapter on it, so...
Is there a way to get that information out in a layperson's format so that...
I think we could work on that for sure. Yeah. Yeah, I think that is something we need to be working on because it is the layperson that we're trying to reach, and they're not going to delve into the peer-reviewed literature.
Even if it was just something on the web page that, you've got the stuff out there about wolves, for example, and that's pretty easy to read, but if... You had something out there that we could refer people to. And, I've asked a lot of folks that have wanted to know about this because, they'll tell me, we've got to have these older, bigger bucks and more numbers of them. And I'll ask them, well, what's your source? What's your justification for that? And I talked to a biologist. What biologist? And I don't remember for sure, but somebody told me that this was going to work. And so I think a lot of this stuff is coming second hand and third hand and fourth hand. And I wonder, a lot of folks are just they just don't have the facts in hand, and if that would help, and you know, at least to the point of how do we have healthier deer herds and more deer.
Yeah, I agree. I think we can do a better job of that. Okay. The northern region and the central region both sort of went along, passed motions agreeing to the DWR recommendation, so we're done with deer.
Okay.
Why don't we take a quick...
Done with general season deer.
Deer manager. Let's take a quick 10-minute break, and we come back and get in the bucks and bulls once in a lifetime.
Sure.
And if we don't talk a lot, I think we can get out of here at a decent
time. All right.
Downhill stretch.
I just think you guys ought to score.
They hunt deer down there with dogs.
Science for a project.
Well, let's do it then.
Okay, Anise.
All right.
We're talking about bucks, bulls, and once in a lifetime.
Yeah.
Here again, I'm going to start at the top of the page. The southern region. Okay. They made a couple of amendments. First, to reduce the Dutton to 110 limited entry elk draw permits. Do you want to address that?
Sure. Yeah, so on the Dutton, it's a unit that's in the, let me just find. Okay. So yeah, it's a unit that we manage for 5.5 to 6, and it has been, you know, on a decline, I guess. We recommended 147 permits, and they're recommending dropping it down to 110. You know, it's one where we're getting close to objective. It's not one, I guess we could live with 110 permits. We just kind of see what happens. It's not one that we're totally against if that's the way it goes. It's probably deeper cut than necessary, but you know, we could probably live with it. And I'll, you know, we'll kind of have to wait and see what the ages do the following year. So the ages for the 3-year average is 5.5, but it did do almost a half year dip from the year prior to this year. So if it was 5.6 and 5.0. So it's right there where it probably needs, well, it probably could be a little bit higher to be in the middle of the range. But so, I mean, a cut's certainly warranted. How deep of a cut is kind of where we're. Well, I think 110, you know, we could try it and see what happens. It's not one that, you know, it's not one that we, I think we needed to make a cut. And whether it's 140 or 110, we'll see where it lays. It's not one that we're
not a whole lot of difference, but
yeah, exactly. So, I guess if the board decided to go with the 110, we would be, you know, we would be willing to go with it.
Anise, really not talking about the Dutton, but since we're talking about the southern region and we were talking about the elk that got killed on the beaver. If I remember right, Blair had a reduction in tags on the beaver unit on the early, but he threw some late ones in to cover the decline in the age population happening there. Am I right on that?
So yeah, so what he did, he didn't throw them in. He just changed the split.
Right.
So he could have a less of a cut and still achieve about the same harvest. So... because the success rate on the late rifle hunt is lower than
he changed. Was it 5 permits?
I don't know the exact numbers. I can
look it up tonight in my motel
room.
Three
permits, I think, is the difference.
But if we're going to discuss that tomorrow, the way I remember, and Anise has kind of confirmed it, we cut some in the early and added them on to the late.
I guess, you know, since we're talking about that and the beaver and those bulls that were killed, you know, we need to keep in mind the way we do it on when we're harvesting the bulls is we're aging them and all that. I mean, 5 more bulls, 5 or 10 or 15 more bulls could be harvested on the spike hunt, you know, without having any effect to that. So, you know, don't put a lot into those five bulls that were killed. It's probably not going to affect the overall population a whole lot. So, you know, you, of course, if you want to discuss it and cut the permits, that's fine. If that's the way you feel you want to go, but you know, five bulls here or there and on a population that's that size isn't going to affect the ages a whole lot. So
in 2011, there were 48 permits, and we've recommended 45.
Right.
We did that right.
Yep. And that's one of those units that was bumped up to the older age class as well.
Okay.
But it was sitting at the older age class before.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, yeah, it did decline. I mean,
which is down from, well, you got the chart there, down from 75 permits in 2009.
Right, yeah. He's made a pretty good cut over the years, and he's just trying to slow down the cut and see where he ends up. But, again, I think his recommendation will get us there. Not one that was really discussed a whole lot in the southern region, but since those bulls were harvested, you may want to discuss it.
Okay. Any more discussion on that? If not, the next item they had is that spike elk on the Monroe.
Right. So that one is one that was brought up. You know, we harvest a few spikes. I think the number last year was 140 or, yeah, 141 spikes were harvested on that unit. Again,
the year before.
What's that?
Do you have the year before?
Yeah, I think it was 96 the year before. Yeah, like 96 the year before, so it was fewer. But I think since we started doing a spike hunt on that unit, it's averaged about 124 spikes harvested. Again, that actually is a benefit to the population. It keeps the bull numbers down, and you're still able to harvest the older age class. I do think people think that spike harvest is going to affect the ages and the later. It likely will not, at least for a few more years, even get into that age class. And even when it does, you have several years of yearlings going into the older age class that it kind of washes it out. So they recommended doing away with the spike because it's below population objective. Really, again, you're mixing populations with buck, bulls, and all that, and it really doesn't make any difference. If the population was lower, the spike bull harvest would decline with it, and so on. So I guess it's not one that we could recommend going with. Again, if you guys decide to do that, that's, you know, we'll deal with it. It is one that's already kind of been voted on when we put the spike units in the guidebook, the application guidebook, even though people haven't purchased those yet. It does show that Monroe unit as a spike unit in the application guidebook, so I'm not sure.
And that would present quite a problem for us now that we've advertised that's open to spike hunting, right, and then to be able to enforce it where it's in the guidebook. I think if the board's inclined to do this, it ought to be done, voted on this fall for 2013, because right, the board has already approved it as a spike hunt, and it's been advertised at that, and then enforcement becomes difficult if you go backwards. But this November, you would be able to vote on it for 2013. I mean, vote on it now for 2013.
Yeah, I agree with you there, Jim. But just to follow up on these, if we're not at objective, and that mountain gets more elk in the summertime than it,
right,
than it does in winter, I understand all that, but if we don't have to kill those bulls as yearlings, why wouldn't we let those grow up to be what people want, and they'll spread themselves between,
sure,
those three mountains?
Yeah, and I can explain that. The reason we've initiated a spike hunt statewide is to actually try to get to objective. I mean, our bottleneck is carrying too many bulls and not enough cows. And when you have an uneven bull-cow ratio, you're producing fewer animals. So if you want to get to objective, you actually should be shooting more bulls. So your cows have more room to produce and all that. So you can be unhealthy in a population if you're upside down, if you have more bulls than cows. And, you know, we do see that on some population. It may be not as bad on the Monroe, but there are, I mean, if you don't harvest bulls, you're going to have more bulls than cows in the long run.
The other way to look at that, Jake, those 125 spikes, by killing them, you made room for 125 cows who will have 60 calves, half of which will be bull calves, which will come back into the population and provide more hunting opportunities.
I agree with you that on some units, but we never kill any cows off that unit.
Well, we are this year. There's quite a bunch.
Just on the Monroe?
Oh, no. I was talking about the Monroe. Sorry.
Yeah, the Monroe is kind of one that's a little bit different than most other units. It doesn't winter a lot of elk, and we may never get to objective on that unit just because it's more of a winter range limited for elk, but it summers a lot of elk, and I think it summers probably over the population objective, even though that's not when we count them. So it's one of those units that's tricky. I think it is a healthy thing to kill those spikes for the population in general, and even though, you know, those bulls may not grow up and become mature bulls, they are, you know, providing an opportunity for hunters at that age that they are being harvested, and it makes for a healthier bull-to-cow ratio.
And I'd like to add, you know, there's 10 to 15,000 hunters a year that are just absolutely delighted to go spike hunting and are delighted to get a spike bull. It's not what they don't want. It is what they do want. So why tell them they can't have it?
Well, I think we provide plenty of opportunity and for spike hunters. But on the same notion, this particular unit has never been at objective. Our whole thing statewide is limited entry. People trying to draw those permits where it takes you 12 to 20 years or longer. We're killing 120, 140 bulls a year that don't have to be done.
But just talking in generalities, that's a good thing because then you can have a larger base herd of calves that produce calves that become yearling bulls and become big bulls.
But we don't have to on that unit.
Yeah, I was just talking on it from a statewide perspective. Statewide limited entry makes sense, but this is a unit that gets a large proportion of spike bulls killed.
Yeah.
And so it is worth thinking about.
Okay. The first year that we hunted there, I called the division office here, and I don't know who it was, one at the rack meetings, but I was told that we killed 226 bulls. And then I asked the same question on what we did on the Fish Lake. We killed more on the Monroe than we did the Fish Lake that year. But that was the first year it came in.
I don't know. Is that the right?
That could be possible. I mean, it's not unlikely. But that has, I guess, what I'm trying to say is just because our winter population is below objective doesn't mean there's not a lot more elk available on that Monroe unit during the hunting season. And even though we're not killing cow elk on the Monroe, a lot of those elk are leaving the Monroe and being killed on other units as cows because they're over objective on those units. So the Monroe is one of those units that sucks them in the summer, but they may be wintering on other units where we are over objective and we are killing them. The Dutton, the Fish Lake, all of those other units. So, you know, just because we haven't been killing cows on the Monroe, it doesn't mean that, you know, we may never get to objective on the Monroe because it's limited by winter range for elk. But the summer range is there where they're sucking them in from other units. So it's just one of those units that is an anomaly. It's not one that we have very many
like. Did you follow up on Paul's request to see if that was actually voted on when he was on?
It was not.
The board?
There's no record of it anywhere.
Now, Alan had all the minutes out. He went over that with you,
yeah,
didn't he?
I don't think he did. Didn't, he might have done it after the
fact. He went over it with May, and I can't remember the answer. What I remember of it, Jake, I'm not sure. What's your question?
Well, it seems to me like Paul's, without going through the minutes, is he made a comment that the Monroe should have been exempt at one time when he was on the board.
But Alan went back and researched the minutes. And what I understand Alan told me, when we went spike-only statewide, we did exempt one unit, Diamond Mountain. It does not have a spike hunt on it. And then also that year we passed a motion where if the unit is below objective, it eliminated cow elk harvest by archery hunters, general season archery hunters. So I wonder if Paul has those two things kind of merged in his mind. Does anybody remember that any different? That's what Alan found out in the minutes.
Yeah, and then there also was a closure at one time before we went statewide spike on the fish lake after we had a lot of elk get killed.
When the fish lake got way low, we cut out the spike harvest. We got cut out all bull harvest.
Right.
And there was two different time frames, Jake. We made a recommendation after talking to Alan, and he's correct me if I'm wrong. We made a recommendation to go with a spike hunt statewide the year before the elk plan came in. And so there were some things that happened in that meeting, but then those were kind of canceled out by the fact that we indoctrinated spike only hunting in the statewide elk plan, which was passed the prior year and was voted on to go statewide spike elk hunt in following the plan. And so there was so the things that had happened the year before kind of went away when the statewide plan was adopted that recommended spike elk hunting on all of our limited entry units. That's how Alan explained it to me the other day. So
yeah, there wasn't nothing in the minutes anywhere that voted on if a population is below objective, we would not do spike hunting.
No, it eliminated cow archery.
Cow harvest from archery hunting. So, yeah, I did go back and look at that, and didn't find anything. So, and really, it doesn't make sense to prohibit bull harvest when you're below objective, below population objective, because the two are not directly related, because you're going to harvest them at the rate that they exist, and if there's not very many, you will harvest not very many, and if there's a lot, you'll harvest a lot. So.
Hey.
But that's kind of our approach to this. I guess we would not recommend closing that unit, but again, you guys can vote for that and do close it. It would give us. I guess we would have to delay it 1 year. Because it's in the
that's another one that would need to be for 2013.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Just another point. When I hired on with the division in 1976, we had 12,000 elk. We got to 60,000 quite rapidly, and that's because we killed every bull and every herd every year, just about. I mean, we killed most of the bulls every year. And that maximizes your production. So if you're interested in increasing elk, the best thing to do is to kill some bulls. If you have a stable situation or you're trying to slow down your growth, have some bulls. They never have calves. But if you're looking at increasing a population, you need to make some room for them by killing some bulls. And that's why spike-only hunting works so well. It kind of maximizes your production. I got to tell you, I ran this whole concept of spike-only hunting before we did it in Utah, past the world's expert on the deer family, who wrote the definitive book called Deer of the World, Valerius Geist. He said, you've just hit on the way to maximize harvest of your elk herds in the state, maximize production and maximize harvest by killing those yearling animals that are surplus, yearling bulls that are surplus to the population, and are mostly just taking up space. It'll allow you to maximize your production and your hunting opportunity. So we're doing the right thing. That doesn't mean that some units shouldn't be treated differently. I don't want to be mistaken in that regard. because some units can get harvested real heavily, real easy.
And you know, we're watching all units in the state and harvest rates and all that. And I think the Monroe's one does have a little bit higher on average harvest than others. But it's still, I think this year, the success rate was around 16% on the spike. So it's not, you know, it's not super high. It has been higher in past years, so it kind of fluctuates. But we'll continue to watch it. But if it is one that, you know, this board feels it needs to be closed, we can certainly do that.
Just another sidelight. You know, when we first got into spike-only hunting, we were killing 80 to 90% of the spikes every year. What did you tell me it was on those
units
now?
It's likely 50 to 60%.
Now it's 50 to 60. We have trained spike bulls to not hang around during the general elk season. And so a much higher percentage of them are now carrying into the older age classes. And that's good.
Yeah.
So things have changed over time. And we know that from a study where we had a large number of spike bulls marked.
Next item, next amendment, is that Zion sheep draw permits, reducing that to 5 total.
Yeah.
So 4 and 1.
Yeah, that one, again, it's not one we could get behind based on our flight data. And then we look at how many permits we put on a unit in two different ways. It's either 30% of the older age class rams or 12% of the total population. And under both scenarios, our 9 permit recommendation is on the conservative side. So we can't see a reason to cut it down to 5. And after that meeting, I actually talked to a few people from FNAS, and they actually supported our recommendation to have the 9 permits because they do believe there's enough rams in that population to harvest it. There was only one person who spoke to this issue in the southern region, and the recommendation was based on that one person's interest. And he is a guide, so he has some vested interest in keeping permits fewer because he can only guide so many people on any given year. So
this is another one I've got phone calls all over the map on. And I know all the guys you're talking about. Sure. And I've talked to, you know, to these guys, and they make a very compelling argument this way. And then I talk to other guides and outfitters who say if there's a sheep unit that really can produce opportunity, this is the one. And if you want to have a true trophy desert sheep unit, pick one with one or two tags that when you get it, you don't got to compete with other people, because you would be losing a lot of opportunity to make this a trophy unit. And they make a very compelling argument. And so I really went back and forth on this. And
yeah,
because, I mean, you're dealing with so few permits. I mean, you're talking about an increase of 3 or 4 permits, you know, either way, or decrease. And it's, you know, that's a tough one. I think the division's done pretty good.
We've used for many years, and it produces stable ram populations year in and year out, and other states use it, Arizona, Nevada. It's a very good formula that's worked a long time.
I asked Troy Justinson, who guides on that unit.
He's one of the guys.
Yeah. I asked him, you know, what do you feel about this guy's motivation that spoke at that? He said, you know, if I was talking as a guide, I would be recommending the same thing, because you would rather have fewer people out there. You grow the biggest rams possible. But he said, it is a unit that but speaking as a sportsman, I think it's a unit that can have lots of opportunities. So it just depends on your motivations and obviously where you're coming from on what recommendations you would make. For us as a division of wildlife, the rams, our older age class rams are there. So, you know, it would not be good for us not to recommend the number of permits that we have. So that's where we're coming from with our recommendation. So we would maintain that our recommendation is a sound one, and
what's your population on that unit then?
Oh boy, I don't know if I have the population. It's over 200 animals. Counted animals. So that, you know, when you put sightability on that, you're...
So for the future, are you planning some transfers from that unit to other units?
We would like to, yeah. We almost did a transplant this year, again, when you transplant, you're not transplanting rams usually, or if you are, they're young rams. So the ram population is going to remain there, and the production is high, so we would see more rams coming into the older age class.
Isn't that unit kind of unique in the fact that it's got the park right there working as a nursery to kind of feed sheep into it? I mean, it's not an island unto itself. It's got a reserve built in right
there.
Yeah,
it's got a built-in nursery, and it is one unit that if you do put too many permits, you may have animals seeking refuge on the park where they're not hunted. So you do have to watch a number of permits, but I think there's enough area to hunt that 9 permits is not going to be too many.
Mike has a PhD on sheep. We ought to hear what he has.
Different kind of sheep.
Been around since I can remember.
So yeah, I think our recommendation is sound, and if anything, it's on the conservative side, and we tend to be on the conservative side when it comes to sheep anyway. So if you look at all of Western states, based on the number of sheep and the number of permits, we're the lowest. So we could probably offer more sheep.
I was going to ask you, I've heard that's true, that when you look, we have as many or more sheep as anybody and still offer the fewest number of permits. So we are still considered very conservative on sheep tags.
We are, for sure, by a long way. But you know, that's what our public wants, and that's kind of the way we manage things.
I just want a sheep.
Me too.
Okay.
I can get you one. I'll even shear it first.
No.
You tag be all right.
Nah. Next item, the Southeast region. Limited entry bull elk tags on the Central Mountains Manti be reduced to 360.
So, yeah. So on this one, we had two different regions that voted on the same unit. So we kind of took the two. So the central region and the southeastern region share that unit. And they were, you know, pretty much, they both thought that there should be some consideration. The central region said they should be status quo. So I think we had 454 permits last year. And then the southeastern region wanted to go back to 2009 levels, which was 360 permits. And we thought that was a bit too much of a cut. I guess we would be okay with a cut between 400 and 430. If we stayed status quo, it could work. But if we were going to cut, we would rather not go all the way back to 2009, 360 permits.
I've got a question for you on this unit, Anise. When you look at during the break, when the director took me out to the woodshed, and we were looking at these numbers. Sure. If you look at last year's number, word objective, if you just look at last year, we were just barely below objective. The average is still above if you go back 3 years. Sure. So if we was to stay status quo, in 3 years, wouldn't we, you think, I mean, we'd be about right on objective. Isn't the idea to land on it and not go below it and then have to cut?
Actually, if we stayed status quo, we may over harvest because we've been bumping up permits so much to get ahead of them. So
I mean, the graph, it's...
Yeah, it's starting to go down, yeah, and that's why, you know, they didn't increase a whole lot, but they do want to get ahead of it. So it's one of those things where we could try either staying status quo or reducing permits.
Or a slight reduction.
And then see what happens. You know, we've done this in the past on this unit, and it bumped back up. So it's just one of those things where we're not sure where that tipping point is. We will get to a point where we'll have to reduce permits because, you know, on any unit right now, we're trying to catch up with the number of bulls. So,
but, I mean, a slight reduction or status quo
is
still fairly in line with what we're trying to achieve on that unit.
Yeah, it is. And that's why we said, when I said we could live with a reduction. If it is a reduction, we don't want to go below 400. Between 400 and 425 would be kind of where we would feel comfortable if it's a reduction because we don't want to go back and then have to increase permits again to try to get to objective if we get a bump in ages.
But we don't want to go so far that we have to make a huge cut in another year or two also. Yep. It'd be nice to kind of land
it would
in the sweet spot there.
That would be.
And John, by status quo, you mean 452?
Well, 2011 is, yeah. And the reason I say that is just because the, that's what the central region.
Yeah,
so
is.
I mean, if we, I mean, if one region's requesting a, you know, a fairly significant cut and one region's requesting status quo, I mean, I think if, sounds to me like Anish should feel somewhat comfortable meeting in the middle there a little
yeah,
ways.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Kind of split the yeah. difference between the
I mean,
the
425
two
or 430 would be kind of where we would like to be, but anywhere in that range would be fine with us.
Okay.
Anish, I read in the minutes there that the CWMU units on that region, their kills are half a year, three quarters of a year, higher on their age class. Than the average is?
No, they're usually about 0.1 to 0.2 or 1 or 2 tenths of a year higher. So it doesn't really make a whole lot of difference when you look at the 3-year average. So it's not.
So do you guys ever separate those out, or are they just always included?
Usually we include them. Now, just, you know, on some units it actually goes the other way. The
right.
CWMUs bring
right.
it down. So because it is part of the unit, those elk are moving back and forth. We want to include them because, you know, those elk don't just live on the CWMU. So, but they do tend to harvest a little bit older age class. But again, it's not that very many bulls, so it washes out when you look at the whole unit. We're offering, you know, 400 and something permits. There may be, you know, 15, 20 bulls killed on a CWMU. It's not that much contributing to the ages.
Not going to bump you a whole year. It
yeah.
might.
The ages may be a 2/10 difference, but once you average them out with the 400, they don't contribute a whole lot to the average, if that makes sense.
One of the things that I sensed, and maybe others that heard can tell me differently, but I kind of got the impression that a lot of the folks that were interested in cutting this back were interested in raising the age, the average age class of the bulls available on the unit, so
yeah.
changing the objective rather than the permits. And
Green.
And so I, that's not what this is all about, right?
Right, there are those on that unit that hunted it when we had too many bulls and are used to seeing a lot of the larger bulls. But the objective isn't set to carry a lot of larger bulls. It's set to carry a lot of the mid-range bulls. And that's where, yeah, you're seeing those folks that maybe want to hunt that unit but want to hunt it, you know, 5 years ago when we were carrying a lot of big bulls on that unit. This unit is managed for a 5.5 to 6-year-old. So, you know, on average, you could expect a 320 to, you know, 310, 320 bull. That's going to be your average for a 5-year-old bull. So, those that are expecting to harvest a 350, 360 bull do want the ages to be higher and would like us to go back to that. But in the management plan, we set aside some units where we decided these are going to be opportunity units and some units where we decided these would be our trophy units where we'll kill the bigger bulls.
This is not the time to change that.
No.
Right?
It's not.
Look at the up management.
Yeah, the management plan. If that, you know, if that's the way they want to manage that unit, once the management plan comes up, we certainly could discuss that. Right now the objectives are set, and we would like to manage towards those objectives. Although I do want to caution, it's a lot harder if we decide to go up to try to just turn that. It's a big ship to turn when you've been trying to kill a lot of bulls for a long time, and now all of a sudden you're trying to build them, and it takes, you know, to get to 7 years, it takes 7 years to get that yearling class to 7 years old.
Talking some severe cuts
yeah.
to get it.
Not only severe cuts, but people have to be patient because it's going to take 7 years before you start building again.
Hey.
A cuts alone won't do it, I guess is what I'm saying. People just need to
you
be
gotta
patient.
Grow the elk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Next item, the Northeast region, book cliffs, deer tag by 50.
Yeah, that's, you know, that's one I don't think we could recommend. It's actually slightly above the 3-year average. It's at 36. I know there's some concern in that region that there's a lot of, you know, maybe 3 points or whatever. I don't think cutting the permits is going to deal with that. So if anything, having those extra permits may harvest a few of those. So for us, it's, you know, recommending by buck doe ratios and by the harvest. I mean, not only buck doe ratios are high, so are you know, satisfaction rates are high on that unit. We have the highest success rate on archery of any units in the state. It's really not a unit where that warrants cutting permits. There are a few guys that are, you know, disappointed with the quality of antlers they're seeing, but that's not, you know, as we talked a little bit earlier, it's not always related to how many you harvest. Sometimes it has to do with the range conditions and how much it rains and things like that.
Has there been discussion about a management hunt on that unit?
Yeah, a couple of, I'm not sure if you were on the board at that time, but the board did decide to, once we open up the statewide plan again, to look at, really the only way we can do management bucks now is if it's a premium unit. And since this the booklet's
that's kind of in the rule, that's written up. Or
it's in the statewide plan, okay, yeah. So either we have to figure out a way to have management buck hunts on non-premium limited entry units, or we have to move the booklets.
Is that in the action log to look at that?
It is.
That may be where I see it. So
it was decided that we would look at it once we opened up the plan next year, okay, the statewide plan.
Can I say something about the book cliff, since sure, it's my favorite place? just in terms of antlers, I've not only worked out there for a long time, but hunted it a lot. And for whatever reason, that unit has a lot of deer that are 3 points on one side, 3x3s or 3x4s. And to have a management buck hunt on that unit, I think you'd be killing the same deer. And you wouldn't necessarily be selecting for antlers with more than four on a side. And so a management buck hunt doesn't make much sense on that unit. I think you've just got to deal with total numbers of tags. And I hunted it 2 years ago. John hunted it last year. There's a large number of deer on that unit, and if you put your mind to it, you can kill a really nice buck. And I don't see any reason to take that opportunity away from the hunters. Yeah. It's a unit that if you want to hunt hard, there's nice bucks available. Nobody hunted it harder than John. He hunted it a lot harder than I did. So I don't see any reason to take that opportunity away. The buck doe ratio is stable.
Yeah.
Population's in pretty good shape. It's a good deer unit.
I think the only concern they have, the biologists and the folks in that area have, that it has had low fawn production, but at least with the numbers of bucks we're harvesting, we're not over-harvesting that. It's been fairly stable buck doe ratios over the last few years. So,
if the buck doe ratio was dropping, I'd dang sure think you want to cut permits.
And that's exactly the approach we're taking.
I've always kind of felt like the buck cliffs is what it is. And I mean, if you try to turn it into the Henrys or the Ponsagon, I mean, you'd have to make such drastic cuts that I don't know if, I mean, I think you'd want to really consider that before you made those kind of cuts.
I agree. Yeah, I agree. I think it's a great unit. I know, and then there are a few people who would like to see more bigger, you know, antlered animals, but some units just have the genetics they have, and you're not going to change the genetics by doing a management buck hunt. You're just going to shift where the harvest is, and you'll have fewer of one and more of the other.
That's your backyard, Dale. What are you hearing?
You know, we're talking biology. That's fine. But the people that are hitting me up are talking socially.
Sure.
They don't like it.
Yeah, I know.
And that's my comment.
Sure.
And I agree with what you guys are saying, but then I also agree with them. And that's why we have rack meetings. That's why we have public input. And so, and we could go through everything, the page and a half we've gone through those so far. The DWR does not agree with what the RACs are saying in a lot of cases.
Right.
And you've given some good, sound reasons for that. But you can't keep shooting the social aspect in the foot at some point in time. I'd probably vote to keep the tags where they are on the book cliffs.
Right.
Because I'm looking at it more from the biology. But I don't want to keep shooting our constituents every time they poke their head around the corner.
No, and I, you know, that's far from what I would like to do. I'm just, you know, I think we've accepted a lot of the things that the racks have put forward as well, knowing that, you know, biologically they're not that different, and socially we could accept them as a division and not cut opportunity a whole lot. So
make a good point, Dell. You know, we spend a lot of time going over these rack recommendations, and we accepted just as many of them as we thought made good sense biologically and for the health of the herds. You do have to factor in social issues, but we take pretty serious what the racks do too, and we tried to accommodate them as much as we can. On limited entry hunts, we probably sided with the racks more than we didn't. On general season, we probably sided more with our recommendation than what the racks did. Yeah. But
just to clarify,
pretty serious.
So Nissan, there, if we thought cutting, when I say we, I mean you, of course. If you thought cutting 50 permits would increase the quality, the overall size of deer on that unit, and increase the, you know, the hunting experience,
right,
you might have a little different take on it. But just cutting 50 permits, in your biological opinion, is just cutting 50 permits and not really accomplishing anything as far as raising quality of the animals on that unit.
Right.
Is that
yeah.
your theory?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, it's just removing 50 tags, it's just going to remove 50 hunters. The number of big bucks on the unit, I think, will remain the same, because you've got a stable buck doe ratio that's, if, you know, if you see in a decline in buck doe ratio, you could say, yeah, you know, they're killing more bucks every year, therefore we need to cut to bring that back up, but that's not the trend we're seeing.
Here, next, I appreciate that, Anise. Next item is those elk permits on the book list, reducing it to 50.
Yeah, that's one that I think we could support going to 130. I think it's one that's kind of teetering. It could go either way. You know, the biologist made a recommendation based on his best experience in the data. You know, if we could, we could certainly go with 130. It's one of those where it's getting close, and I think we could try to see where that'll land us.
Is that your recommendation? What was your recommendation for?
Well, our recommendation initially was on the book list. How many? 153. So it's
the 130, and that's your bull tags.
Yeah, that's the limited entry elk tags. Yeah.
Well, that's not a huge deal then.
No, it wouldn't be.
Not a deal breaker. It's not going to make a lot of difference one way or another.
Probably not. I mean, it may actually, you know, I don't know. I mean, when you get close to that point, it's kind of hard to say, you know, 10 permits one way, 10 permits the other, where you're going to land with the ages. So it's one of those where you're using a lot of science, but you also, you know, trying to not go overboard on some of these as well. So there's some.
What you, just by doing that, what you would do is, you know, not kill them, but just, you know, give them half of what they wanted.
Yeah, and actually, you know, on that one, we could go with
two.
We could go with what they recommended, with what the RAC recommended, and we'd be fine with it. 130 right. permits.
Okay. Going on down northern region.
Can I ask a question?
Go ahead.
When we get these recommendations that come from the RACs and the general public, generally speaking, what are they basing their numbers on? I mean, 130, why not 133 or 127? And, you know, I guess these are just gut feelings as much as anything.
Out there, I think so. You know, they're just picking an easy number without going too far, but an easy number to try to make them, if you will, feel better that they got some kind of reduction, because they'd like to see that elk and deer turn around.
Sometimes, like on the Manti, it's they don't want to increase from last year, so let's keep last year's number like the central region did, or let's go back to the 2009 level or whatever. So they're picking a number off the list from years past when they felt more comfortable with that number. But
I mean, these guys are running models and predictions and all kinds of things to try and figure out where that is. And there's a lot of subjectivity in this. I mean, you can't absolutely control what a hunter kills. That's what we were talking about on the break. Not every hunter wants the biggest bull on the mountain. Some of them are fine with
the first good bull. Yeah, I mean, we're taking long-term averages and things like that because that's all the only data you can count on. But yeah, like Jim mentioned, you can't count on it. That's why we can factor in the social, as Dell said, and if it's 130 instead of, you know, our 153, if they're okay with less opportunity, it's not going to hurt the population biologically, then less opportunity is what the public wants. That's what they get.
I guess what I'm thinking is, this just came to me, and so it probably doesn't mean much, but in the recommendations, why not plus or minus 10 or 15 permits?
Yeah.
If it doesn't make that much difference overall, I mean, we're talking 23 permits on this one, right?
Yeah. I mean, on some units, plus or minus 10 is a big deal. On some of these smaller units and some on the bigger units, it's not. So, you know, we like to make a recommendation that way. We're not leaving it up to... You know, because in some areas they're always going to pick the lower number, in some areas they're always going to pick the higher number. So you're not leaving it up. So the board has to decide, because the northern region picked all of the higher numbers and the southern region picked all the lower numbers. We end up in the middle anyway. So we want to make as best a recommendation as we can that will get us to that number. And by putting a range around it, it's really, you know, it makes it look like it's not as meaningful when it really is. I mean, this is the number we think that needs to be there to achieve it. Like, you know, we could be wrong by as much as this many on either side, but that's not what we would recommend. Just because when you do that, then the error has error around it, and so you're not making the best recommendation you can.
But generally speaking, plus or minus 10% is going to be within the margin of error, sure. Error and not make a big difference.
Exactly.
You said 130 was okay.
Yeah.
This one, you know, right. It's 20.
Yeah.
To be honest, if you felt nervous, you could probably throw 140 in this till patch on the back. And
I guess what I'm getting at is we spend a lot of time arguing about 5 to 10 permits sometimes. Yeah. And to me... there might be some more important things to.
Well, yeah, I think that
I understand. What you're
I think that goes back to Dell's, you know, comment on we shouldn't always discount the public, because they have certain, you know, they come to these meetings and they say what they mean, and if we always discount them, then they'll stop coming and basically say, you know, why do we come anyway? I think that, you know, if it's an issue that we can take the social aspect into it. Those people that do show up, I think we should listen to them when we can. And that's I think, where the division comes at it from. So we're not, disillusioning the public that does come and participate.
I think a lot of times, too, like when we look at, like on the Manti, going back to the 2009 number, that's a number you can relate to, because you know how many people were on the mountain, the elk that were killed that year,
right.
The experience that people had. And, I mean, it's not just a random number. It's a number that has some history and some experience and some data tied to it.
Right.
And, you know, like you say, 10% on the 10 or 12 permits on the Manti ain't that big of a deal.
Right.
10 permits on the Pavon or the San Juan is a much bigger deal.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, you know, and that's, again, Mike, that's why we would like to recommend a number. And then there's going to be, you know, people that think we're off this way or that way. And that's where the public process comes in. I think we have to have a public process, because that's where we get, those passionate people that come out and say, you know, sure, we don't probably hear from the general public, but for the most part, we can gauge from surveys and things what the general public wants. And the division's always looking out for the general public, but takes inputs from the extremes. It's kind of the way it turns out.
Okay, thank you. Next thing I'm going to go to, northern region, sort of went with the DWR. Central region, we go back to the Manti. We've already talked about that because up there on the southeast regions. So let's go ahead.
Talk about some in the central region that got brought up and then the RAC chose not to take action on. That's the Wasatch. And I was talking to the director about this. We have fewer elk with just as many permits on the Manti. I am seriously worried that we're headed for a cliff there.
On the Wasatch?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we need to take a real look there and see if it might not be time to start to rein in, because I think that I don't understand how we can have as many elk or the permits be so similar on two units that one has twice as many elk as the other one.
And I think with elk especially, you know, we do, it's a winter time survey, but they could be some of the Manti elk that we survey could be summering on the Wasatch, and then some of the South Slope elk that we survey could be summering on the Wasatch. So we could have a lot more elk summering on the Wasatch than we count in the wintertime. And that's, you know, I think that's where the differentiations come in. And then we could have just an older age class of bulls on the Wasatch, and it's taken us longer to dip into that.
So if what you just said is true, if we did have a surplus of older bulls on the Wasatch more than we thought, and we keep adding tags, mm-hmm. when we break over the top of that, aren't we standing right on the edge of the Grand Canyon there?
Really,
I mean, we're not that far. If we keep adding tags like we are, we ain't that many years away from having as many elk permits as we have, or many bull permits as we have bulls.
Yeah, but there's no, I guess the fear for me is not there, because you're recruiting bulls every year, and every 5 or 6 years, you know, you've always got yearling bulls coming into the population, so you're not losing, you're not going to run out. You are going to see a point where you're going to have to reduce permits, but on the Wasatch, we haven't even slowed down yet. We're still, ages are still climbing.
Anise made a really good point that I haven't thought about for a while, but years ago they did a big telemetry study in Strawberry Valley, and they put a large number of radio collars on elk, and we were just dumbfounded where those things wintered. A large migration coming out of Strawberry down through White River and as far as the Green River on the Range Creek unit, and across and over into Gordon Creek and down into Spanish Fork Canyon. And so we're dealing with animals that sometimes migrate long distances, and we're counting them on other units. I hadn't thought about that for a while. Yeah. It was a good point.
But we know that the day's going to come where the well's going to run dry, and we're going to have to make some major cuts there.
Yeah, we certainly know that. But at least until we get to a leveling off point, which we haven't on the Wasatch yet.
Well, the age class is held pretty level.
Yeah.
And we keep at, I mean,
it's gonna.
I'm concerned.
Well,
I'm concerned that we're going to go, that we ain't going to wake up until our car's burning in the bottom of the canyon.
Where I start to get concerned is when I start seeing a downward trend, and we're still not there yet. Once I see a year that actually drops the ages, that's when we'll start saying to the biologists, okay, it's time to start reining in.
I hope there is a year between the edge of the ledge and the bottom of the canyon.
There's actually at least 5 or 6 years, because we managed for 5.5 to 6 years.
Yeah. So I hope your insurance is paid up.
Lots of it.
All right.
That's one thing you could count on, is elk living from 1 year to the next. Unless a bullet hits them. I think on the Wasatch, you're right that the RAC did vote on it and decided, you know, we're still seeing that climb. And I think rightfully so. I think, you know, it's one of those units where we haven't even seen a dip in ages. So I do get the comments where we're killing the quality, but again, that's probably by design, because we are managing for
five. And I understand that. I mean, I know that the quality is the social part of it, and the management target is the age.
Right.
And I understand that.
Right.
I wish there was a way to balance those two out a little better than just the age, because what the teeth in the mouth say doesn't at all mean what the horns say.
Yeah. And I think once we get to a point where we're leveled off, and then we start actually backing off permits, you'll start seeing some of the quality come back, because obviously with fewer permits, less bulls are getting killed, unless those top ends get killed. So we'll get there. It just takes a little while, especially when you start so far behind. And as you know, in the beginning, we were fought on every permit we put on that unit when I was in the region. And I made a statement one time that we could probably double the permits, and here we are, we're probably quadruple the permits now that we were back then. So,
on half the elk that you have on the Manti, the same number. Something's going to give.
Half the wintering elk.
Something's going to give.
Something will give, and that, you know, we'll reduce permits when the time comes.
Okay.
But that's, I think that's
Thank you. I got one other item, and that is just.
I'm afraid I'm sitting in the front seat right now.
Antlers permit recommendation of 250 antlerless antelope on the plateau rather than 100.
Sure. So that one, the plateau unit, as you know, we had some winter mortality a couple years ago, so we actually basically didn't have any antlerless permits except for one small hunt on some ag land. They flew it this last year, and it's back up to objective. That's a unit that always rebounds really quickly. So the region felt they would slowly get back into the doe antelope business and offer 100 permits until they made sure that the recovery was, you know, in full swing before we issue hundreds and hundreds of permits on that unit. So, and that is a unit that, you know, folks from that area realize that it has a potential to get ahead, and I think that's why that region recommended more permits on pronghorn.
Your 100 is your safe bet then.
Yeah, it's basically to get started. I think once we fly it next year, if we see that the same trend we've seen in the past, we probably will have quite a few more antlerless or doe pronghorn permits.
Okay.
Jake, I got a question for you on that one. It didn't seem like there was much discussion of it until everything was closed to the public, and then all of a sudden this thing came up and got talked for a couple of minutes, and that was a motion, and everybody voted. And division didn't get much input, and the public didn't get much input. Is that?
There was no public left.
Okay.
They'd gone home. It was like 11 o'clock. That's what I was referring to earlier. And, you know, to tell you the truth, I think the antelope will be okay even if we vote that way tomorrow. But the second one, which we'll talk about in a minute, kind of concerns me a little bit.
But let me just remind you, I believe it was 2010, I did an emergency closure on two hunts on the Parker Mountain on the plateau, and I don't want to get back there again. I want to make sure we've got a herd that's increasing, and there's enough permits there to stabilize it. So with 100, we really don't need 250. I don't know where that came from. That's on a 1500 head objective. A lot of permits on 1500 head.
Well, I'd have to lean that way too. When the division says kill with caution, you better kill with caution. Because I know if there could be permits on there, Anise would have the permits. I'm just saying.
I know where the structure of the motion came from, okay, and you guys too, because you've read the minutes and everything. All I'm saying is, if it happens to go that way, I think you'll see the antelope come back with your permits quicker than what you would with like an elk tag or something like that, because of the way they reproduce. But I'm not saying that's what we need to do.
What I'm hearing, it sort of sounds to me, it makes sense to go with the 100 this year, and you could come back to 250 or 300 next year.
Yeah,
if it comes back.
Always add.
Exactly. Yeah, and that's
antelope traps on that unit too that we can.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's one unit where we've used as a nursery herd, and we do have some places we could put antelope if we needed to catch some this December. We certainly could, and move them.
No other discussion on that. I'm going to go to that last item, that 500 antlers elk on the plateau, Thousand Lake, Fish Lake.
Okay, so that one was a pretty tricky one. They flew the unit this year, but under very marginal conditions, and they weren't able to fly the surrounding units that they usually fly. So Vance didn't feel very comfortable with the flight he had. So what he did is do what we do on years when we don't fly, is model that population. And he came up with about the number of being almost, you know, that population being at objective. So between the model and the flight, he felt uncomfortable with both, I guess, because his flight was low, but his model was high. So he decided basically to issue no permits until he maybe had another year to be more comfortable with the data he had. So it was one of those things where he probably shouldn't have flown it, to be honest. But he flew it and didn't have very good condition. He was counting elk at 9,000 feet. I mean, it was after a fresh snow, but the elk hadn't moved down to concentrated winter ranges. So it was one of those things where, you know, he was getting pressure to know how many elk are there. He flew it probably under less than optimal conditions, got a low count, which is what usually happens when you fly under less than optimal conditions. Didn't really totally trust the count, and I wouldn't have either. So he modeled a population, but then his model obviously is going to come up higher than if he had a low count. So because he was uncomfortable with either, decided to recommend no permits. That's kind of where it came from. So that's where the recommendation from the RAC there said, well, if we're at objective, which is what his model number says, we should have permits, which is probably true if we're at, but he wasn't sure that he's at objective because the flight was different. So he had two, you know, pieces of information that told him two different things, and he decided to play the safe and not have any permits, and figured if he got good conditions to fly next year, he could try to make up the number of permits.
A unit where we did an emergency closure 2 years ago, and it was good we did, because you just can't discount an elk flight that low, that far below objective. That's why we shouldn't fly them on brown ground. They actually had pretty good snow cover the day they flew, but the elk were at all elevations. We've overshot that herd before, and it created a lot of discomfort among sportsmen and the division and everybody else, and I just think this is one we ought to be cautious about. Or we throw 500 tags on that unit where we have a history of over-harvest and where we have a emergency closure not that long ago, better be careful. And I think 500 is really excessive.
How many tags did they have the year before, antlerless?
500 to 800, the way I remember. I think it was 5, wasn't it, the year before?
It was more than that, but...
So...
If I might. When they flew that this year, they counted, I think, 2,800 plus or whatever animals. But I think the real criteria goes back to 3 years ago when we had 1,200 tags on that unit all at once, and we had 2 to 3 feet of snow on the ground, and we killed, I think, all of those 1,200 plus the wounded ones. I think that flaws what his second one that Anise talked about is if you might help me, Jim, what am I trying to think of?
Population model?
Yeah, his model. I think it got flawed in that first year because of those range conditions when we were killing those elk. That's my whole take.
I guess, you know, just to clarify that all the harvest that occurred goes into the model. So I think that was all accounted for. So, I mean, I think he felt pretty good about the model population, but he just, you know, because he couldn't justify it with a count, didn't feel comfortable putting permits on. That's, you know, I don't know.
I flew that unit twice with these gentlemen, and we've had good conditions, and we've still had elk, what I thought was extremely high elevations. You know, they were always bulls and things like that, but I wasn't able to go this year. But
I would, my looking at the whole situation, not just the number that he came up with, as I look at the whole situation and the way you describe it and talking to everybody, when you have a biologist that doesn't feel good enough about the data that he's got two different ways with the model and the count, and is willing to sit on it and make sure he gets it right, I think we ought to let him get it right. I don't think we add permits, which, you know, or cut permits.
Yeah.
If he says, give me another year and make sure we get it right, I think we ought to let him get it right.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, my personal opinion, but I think and he ought to be commended for, you know, instead of just coming up with something arbitrary that he doesn't feel good about,
John,
let him get it right.
Let me give you another thought, though, on that. We've watched the Fish Lake has been the most emotional elk unit in the state for 15 years. And I'm worried about overshooting the harvest, but I'm also worried about undershooting the harvest. And I remember all the years that the Southern Rack wanted to reduce and reduce and reduce the permits. And pretty soon the population gets so bloody high that everybody understands that we got to have a 1,600 antlerless harvest year and goes. And then because of weather conditions, which several times has produced the problem, a bigger snow than is normal, you over-harvest that large number or something. So I'm worried about undershooting as well as overshooting, and I'm worried that if we don't do any this year, that the flight next year may say, holy criminy, it's up at 5,600 or 5,800, and now the division's obligated to put out 1,200, 1,400 permit.
Do you have this year's cow tags for that unit on in front of you there? How many are there going to be this year?
This year?
Zero.
Zero.
Zero. Now, if we're at zero, I don't know the undershoot. I mean, and once again, we are talking about a unit, like the director said, that a couple, 2 years ago had an emergency closure.
Yep, I hear you. But that unit can go boom or bust depending on the hunt and other things very, very easily. And I think we get into trouble every time we go big number or zero.
Yeah.
Every time we get socially forced or biologically forced into going big numbers and little numbers, it turns around and bites us in the butt.
So where did this number come? Why this many tags? If the biologist is saying none, why 500?
Well,
what was the logic there?
So basically, if you have a population that's at objective, you know, it's 4,800, you know, the number of calves produced and how many you would have to do to even just maintain it at objective would be at least 500. It'd probably be more if it, but, you know, I just looked and we had 860 last year, 860 permits. Obviously, 500 permits isn't going to be 500 dead elk, but, you know.
Ideally, where you want to be is a pretty stable antlerless harvest over time, and none of us like this boom and bust thing. And on most units, we figured that out over time. The Fish Lake, for whatever reason, has kind of been volatile that way. We get high counts and then low counts, and I'm not sure when you only count one part of that area, you're getting the whole picture. And we were unable to, Nice said this, but we were unable to count those other units, and so there's a lot of discomfort. Had it been a normal winter, we'd have been just fine if whatever the recommendation was.
So one thing we've...
It would have been zero.
But. Yeah, I agree. One thing we've committed to do on not this unit specifically, but that group of units, is try to manage more of a group of units because we do have a lot of interchange. And now that we've got some radio caller data, we're able to do that. So in the future, what we want to do is count them all, figure out where we need to harvest antlerless elk and have a more stable. So in a lot of instances, we move elk when we hunt them instead of actually killing them. And so they end up on another unit. So you have a lot of high harvest here, then they move. So you're playing a shell game with them in a lot of instances. So if we manage it as a group of populations as one population, we can better manage it. And we're going to that approach on elk on multiple places in the state because we found that they're moving around a lot more from unit to unit than deer do.
So I got a question for you and the director. Would you rather have no tags this year and end up having to shoot a few more next year or shoot elk this year that you end up needing next year?
You know, I wish we had better information. I would rather have tags this year if I were really comfortable with the numbers.
If you were comfortable with the numbers.
Than having to bump, than have twice the number we need next year. But again, I'll have to defer to Vance because he's the one on the unit. And if he feels uncomfortable with it, so do I.
and that's kind of, I think we can catch up. I just hope we have to have that as many permits that we move.
Personally, I would think you'd be better off having a few more elk than you thought you had than having less elk than you thought you had.
You sure don't want to repeat several years ago when we drove that elk herd down pretty low.
Yeah.
It took way too long for it to come back.
And you can always shoot them.
Yeah.
And so I don't, even if we're wrong, I don't think it's going to put us that far behind that we can't make it up in the future.
Great.
And I was around, I think I was either the big game coordinator or the once in a lifetime coordinator when that went down last time. And I saw how ugly that was. And it devastated our people in the southern region. Jeff Granison never really recovered from it. He retired shortly after that.
But on the other hand, the reason we were there and the reason he recommended the blue light special there, which worked, by the way, on three other units beautifully. The only place it didn't work was on the fish lake. He took the brunt for that. He got castigated and pilloried and crucified for 5 years.
Oh, yeah.
And the southern region did. And it was because we'd socially opposed harvesting antlerless elk and kept disagreeing with the division. So then we turn around and we say, oh, my God, we got to fix this mess. We've got to avoid the boom and the bust.
Yeah, and I do make a commitment to that. I think once we get back into the elk business on that unit, I'm going to work very closely with the region to have a permit number that is not going to be fluctuating that much, where we could just maintain it for several years in a row and see if we can get it where we need to without having 2,000 one year and 1,000 the next and so on. So,
Anise, do you have last year's kill on that, on your antlerless?
Probably.
And while you're looking for that, I'm just going to say that I'm the representative in that area, and I don't know how many cow hunters would call me wanting to know where there was any cow last year, because they could not find them, at least the ones that were in our area there. So.
Yeah, last year was a very tough year for cow walk hunting because they stayed high. 328 is what was harvested last year.
320 out of 860?
Yeah.
Let me just say one thing here, because we're getting close to the end, and I want to say it, but it's been a good discussion, and one thing I appreciate that's come out of this last few minutes, I want to express my appreciation to these local biologists. Statewide, they have a really good feel for what's on the ground. And if I vote for anybody, I'm going to vote for those guys, because they know a lot more about it than I, and when I talk to them, I always appreciate what they're saying. So I appreciate what they've said, and he's saying, the only way I can be safe is zero, because I don't trust either one of these items.
Right.
And I'm just going to go with that, because I'm comfortable
with
that.
You want to split the difference and go with 250. Is it worth doing a small number like that? Is that going to appease the natives on one side or the other?
I that's a social issue. I don't know who it'll appease. It's going to be a decision that you guys can make. I
think what was bad on it, and I'm not saying anything against Steve or whatnot, but that motion was combined with antelope and elk. And I think if it would have been separate, the one would have passed and the one wouldn't. That's my personal opinion.
I have a hard time believing that the biologist would paint himself in a corner next year, too. I'm sure he's looking down the road and thinking what he's got coming. I just have a hard time thinking that if zero permits was really going to put him in a bind next year one way or the other, that he'd feel comfortable doing that either.
Yeah, I think there's some mitigating circumstances that helped him with that. He's betting on raising the objective. Hopefully this is coming up, this next RAC meeting, which he shouldn't have considered, because that's not a for sure thing. So that's another thing. If the objective is raised on that unit, if he was wrong, then he doesn't have to make up as many elk. So.
But we can't base
exactly.
Do this year on that.
On that, yeah.
We're committed to what the objective is now. I just want to point out one more thing. Since we flew that unit last, we've done 10,000 acres of habitat improvement on it at a cost of over $1 million. We've made room for some elk. I mean, gives you some buffer there.
Well, and we know it can carry more. It's carried as many as, you know, 6,000 or 6,500 in the past. So, but, you know, we have to try to manage to our objective. That's what we're
I ask just a quick question about the emergency closures. When do you actually do that? Is that before the season, mid-season? And how does that affect the hunters that are involved?
That was actually done after the general hunt. We got lots of comments from hunters that the elk are just not there. We had a lot of early snow, and we had the elk sitting on winter ranges just ripe for a slaughter. And after we reviewed the harvest information and the population model, we decided another antlerless hunt late in the year in deep snow could have been catastrophic. That's what got us in trouble years ago, was a late fall hunt in deep snow. So we canceled that last hunt. Glad we did now. Now we've got another low count to deal with, and dang glad we canceled that last hunt.
So what happens to the hunters in that situation? Do they get a refund?
Yeah,
they eat the tag?
They did, no. They didn't have an opportunity to hunt. They got a refund.
Hey, that, unless I'm missing something, that's the last differing amendment that we have. So with that, from my standpoint, I think this has been very helpful.
Yeah.
In moving forward to tomorrow and future years, I'd recommend we do something similar.
And I would like to comment that having gone through the RAC meetings, it was probably one of the better RAC tours. I think even though there were some disagreements, I mean, there was a lot of recommendations there, and I think there was agreement on the majority of them. So I do want to shine the light on how many things we agreed on versus the things we disagreed
sure.
on. So.
Absolutely. We've got hundreds of recommendations here, and yeah. we've discussed a couple of dozen right. where we differ. So I mean, it's
probably less than that.
There's a lot of agreement this year, better than I've seen in a long time on division recommendations.
Hey, thank you, Anise.
Mr. Chairman, can I just say also I appreciate Anise going over these and being very candid and honest about where the division can get behind a RAC recommendation and why, and also where they can't and why. I think that lends a lot of credibility to the RAC process. Having sat on one of those boards for many a year, as everybody else up here did, it gets extremely discouraging when you feel like you're window dressing and that the board is the only thing that matters, and it does. I think it lends a lot of credibility to the whole process when RAC recommendation finds its way into the motions and the results of this board.
Yeah.
And so I appreciate you explaining those reasons why you feel biologically or socially you can or can't support, because I think it makes it a lot easier for us to get behind a RAC recommendation. And I think if we don't look for ways to incorporate what the RAC comes up with into our recommendations, I think we do the whole process a disservice. And I know, as having been a RAC member, that gets extremely discouraging.
It does. And you know, I having been part of this process, I think it's one of the best processes in the West. I've worked in other states where, you know, basically it's just one board decides everything, and they have different ways of getting input from the different areas, but it's not as comprehensive. And even though it can be a frustrating process at sometimes, I honestly enjoy it, getting to interact with all the other folks and getting that input. I think it's a process that does work if people allow it to. It's not a, sometimes it is frustrating. Not everybody gets what they want, and that's.
Well,
that's
to me, it's very interesting to see how proposals that start at the southern region or whatever one usually go first, how things evolve to mm-hmm. the time this board actually votes.
Yeah.
Not just from the division side, but from the public. I mean, things have a tendency to grow together, usually for a positive.
Yeah.
And I think that's the best part about the whole thing.
It is. Yeah. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Okay, variance rule, Mr. Gregg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, board members. Well, this is one that I think you're all familiar with. We've talked about it in these meetings two or three, a couple of times now at least. And what we found is that a rule that was passed in 2008 isn't working exactly the way we'd hoped back then. I think in January or so, we came and showed you some of the trends that are occurring, and I think there was some agreement at that time that we maybe revisit this rule and make some modifications to it. So we've gone back and done just that, made some modifications. This is kind of a complex thing. You know, this is one that the public really doesn't understand. It makes me a little nervous taking this out to the RACs because the RACs and the public don't generally deal with these things. You as board members have all dealt with these almost at every board meeting we have. And the division deals with a lot more. And this is kind of a concept of fairness. And fairness in this case is in the eye of the beholder. The division variance committee that was created in 2008 has the rules coordinator, who's Stacy. It has Judy Tutter, our license coordinator. Has Kevin Bunnell, the wildlife's chief, and myself, or the four people that make up this variance committee. So we went back, we sat down with Marty Bushman and some of our others in our group, Brian and Lacey and Kenny and others, and tried to come up with something that's going to help all of you not have to deal with some of the issues that we deal with, but still try to be fair, if you will, to the public. This handout is kind of a brief synopsis of what we've come up with. And there's going to be a couple tough things in there. There's some concepts of this that are a little bit different what the board has had to deal with, and that we actually created some provisions, and I'll talk about that in a few minutes, that restrict your authority as a board to address situations that pop up down the road. And part of that is because we had our variance committee, and if they didn't like what we came up with, they just came to you. We couldn't be a definitive end of the game, if you will. So it kind of negated some of that. We did all the easy stuff, and you still got all the hard stuff. So what we're trying to do is say, here's what the board cannot do. And like I said, we'll talk about that in a minute. So the reason that the individual can have a variance is if they're substantially precluded from hunting because of personal illness or injury, death or significant illness of a family member or a group member, or military deployment. So that hasn't changed. We've not changed those definitions or any of the criteria. We have made a change. The next one, variance must be received within 120 days of the season closure. That has been 200 days in the past. So what we said is, as long as you come talk to us within a couple hundred days after the season ends, we're going to work with you. We want to cut that back a little bit. Fortunately, most of these variance requests happen before even 120 days. The next one, and we had lots of debates internally about this, but what does substantially precluded mean? And you see, you've seen this at many board meetings, which is people come in and say, I hunted for a day or half a day or a weekend or 3 days. I never got anything, but then I got hurt or something happened in life. And, you know, here's, I had 18 points trying to get this thing, and, you know, what can you do for me? So what we've come up with is that if you've hunted 2 days or less, okay, maybe that could look like an opening weekend, if you will, that would, and didn't harvest, we're saying that, you were substantially precluded. Now, that could be 1 day. Could be 1 hour, could be 1 minute. But what, again, we're doing is we're going to say you can't appeal this stuff back to the board. So what we're trying to do is give them a fair enough window that they maybe had been out there and something happened and they never killed anything. So we're not talking about, you know, you killed something and now what more do you want? We're saying if you went up to 2 days in the field and then were injured or illness or these other things, we could grant you a variance. Now, we'll talk in a moment. Now, what are these variances going to be?
Greg?
Yes?
Clarify for me. The division can grant a variance if there's two or less days hunting in the field. Is that what this says?
Yes.
And if they have more than 2 days, they'd have to go to the board.
If they had more than 2 days, then they had substantially participated and couldn't go to the board.
Could not go. Oh, I see it. Okay, sorry.
what we're saying is, you know, if you're out there 4 days hunting and didn't get one and got hurt, sorry, you know, you should have got one. And how do you know what that number of days is? You don't, you know. Again, it's fairness in the eyes of the beholder. So the three types of variances that we have are season extensions, bonus or preference point restoration, and waiting period waiver. You as a board have approved all three of those in the last 6 months. So those are still options. We haven't taken those off the table. But here's where probably the biggest change comes into play, is what are we going to do for you now? You've hunted less than 2 days. You had an illness or injury. And there's three categories, if you will, kind of boxes down in the middle of that page. Everyone's got this handout, I assume. One is, on the left, preference point restoration. If you had a permit for any of those types of seasons, I won't read them all, but there's general deer and antlerless and a couple of types of waterfowl or birds and that. If you had one of those and became eligible for a variance, we'll give you your preference points back. No refund, but you can get your points back. So we kind of made you whole, if you will. And then you'd also earn one for that year. So it's kind of like you never drew the thing. Okay, the next category, the center category, is bonus point restoration and waiting period waiver. So in this case, you'd get your bonus points back. All right, and you can see all the categories. It's mostly our limited entry once in a lifetime stuff. But it does also include convention and sportsman permits. And that was one that we struggled with a lot as well, because you didn't use any points to draw those permits. So you're not getting anything back. So basically, in those examples, you're getting your waiting period waived, if you will. You can still come back to the division and continue to apply and draws without waiting periods. Those could be ones that you have people not happy about down the road, because if a guy had 14 elk points and he drew and couldn't participate and qualified for a variance, he's going to get 14 points back plus one. He's got 15. So that individual might have a chance again next year. You know, if on a convention or sportsman, it's sorry, you know, go again next year and maybe you'll be lucky. But he didn't have a lot of skin in the game either. He didn't have 14 years of applying for convention permits. So that's how we opted to go on that one. The final category on the right, season extensions. So this is what we've pretty much been doing with everything lately. And now we're going to just leave a few categories there. The categories are conservation permits, poaching reward permits, private CWMUs, and limited entry landowner. Now, the first thing, I don't know what first comes to your mind, but what came to our mind first is it's going to say, well, are we just doing things for the rich people? They can hunt next year and all the poor guys got to go back in the draw. And I think that's really not how we viewed this. What we viewed this as, with the exception of poaching reward permits, which is just a few of those here, and I don't think we've ever had a variance request for a poaching reward. So if we can ignore that one for a moment. Conservation, private CWMU, and limited entry landowner all have a factor that's makes them very different, which is there's a third party involved who's getting money, whether that's a private landowner or a sportsman organization. And because there's a lot of time that passes before these variances could come in, these groups or landowners could have already spent all that money. So it's hard for us to just say, well, you can have your points back and you'll get it next year. You know, too bad for you. And they'll say, well, I bought this and I have any points, so you're telling me I'm losing all my money. So what we did is we said, well, if the landowners will agree to add that permit on next year, on the landowner case, on top of their quota, will allow you to do that. And we've done that in the past with these extensions on these private ones. We said only if the landowner allow it. We can't force a landowner to have more permits than we agreed on. So if they can negotiate that with the landowners to be added onto their permits for next year, we'll extend those to the next year. Conservation permits, again, the concern is they pay a lot of money, which whether you like those individuals or not, they're very important to the funding of the division, those conservation dollars. And the groups get that money and they go spending it and they're doing habitat projects and doing different things. It's hard for us to 120 days or whatever after the season ends, which could be February or March of the next year. They may have gotten paid that money a year prior to that. say, well, go back to the conservation group and get your $100,000 back for your Henry's tag or whatever, because that money was probably long since spent. So it kind of makes a third-party complication there. So in these categories, we've agreed to or are recommending a season extension. The last thing on here, the board cannot consider grant or variance if, and here's the categories, if it's over 120 days, you can't hear it. And you've had people, it was 200 before, and we had one a few months ago. They went about 280 days and came to the board, and the board approved it and said, well, okay, we'll go with 280 days. So we're limiting your authority here. Applicant hunts more than 2 days, you're out. Season extensions on any hunt other than the ones we mentioned. Season extension beyond a year, and an animal is harvested. So if any of those criteria happen, we're going to have to say, sorry, the board can't hear it. And you're probably enjoying that right at the moment, but there's going to be a sad case out there. There's going to be someone who found out they had cancer or got their leg shot off in the military. There's things that happen. The problem is if we can't write a rule that we can have some teeth in, we might as well not do that, because every time we tell them no, they're coming straight to you guys. So that's it's a decision. And Marty isn't here, but he's trying to get back before this ends. But he's trying to, or he's developed that. And I don't know that you have any rules that you address with the whole wildlife board that preclude you from hearing an appeal. So that's a very different concept we've got, Bill.
Yeah, I just had a question. We've had a couple situations in recent times where a conservation tag owner arrived and found out that he had been given the wrong tag, or the dates were wrong, or the season he was supposed to hunt, and they've asked for a variance. I don't see a situation in here that would cover something like that.
Well,
those have been division errors.
If there's errors or third-party errors, we've got a different...
The conservation group made a mistake, too.
Yeah.
Well, in terms of how they assigned it and whatever.
There are times we've concluded those are agents of the division, yeah. So we have an error rule, which we address all kinds of errors through. And we have a variance rule, which is, and they're two different committees or two different rules, actually. And we address those sometimes. It doesn't mean you're not ever going to hear anything as a board again. It doesn't mean you still can't deny some things or we can't deny some things. There's gray area here. You know, what we've got to deal with daily is people come, we've got the word significant injury or illness. And that's a toughie. You know, it comes in and people say, well, I was pregnant and I really didn't feel like I could hunt. Is that significant or not? You know, it's easy if you had major surgery. I mean, there's the easy ones are pretty easy for everybody to know, but the tough ones, you know, we're still going to have to make some judgment calls along the way as a variance committee here. I don't know if this is the perfect rule revision. If not, we might have to try it again in a couple years and we see what's going on. I think that, and you've got the graph on page two, I think the rule that we wrote in 2008 probably wasn't the perfect rule then. I think there's 156 happy people this year that we're able to be as flexible with them as we were, but I'm not sure that's a pattern we want to continue.
I remember a couple of them that aren't too happy.
A few that you told no to, but a lot heard yes.
So. Isn't it true that we need some feedback on the two-day deal, whether you think that's the right period of time? We had a lot of debate on that. And then whether we got the permits in the right categories, we've had a lot of debate on that. And we actually picked it apart again just recently to make sure we felt like we had like permits in like categories. But one of the basic things of this is people are only going to be made whole. They're not going to get something beyond what they really deserved. And I think one of the problems is we've been given season extensions for people that it made them more than whole. And so, anyway, we need a little bit of feedback, especially on the two-day deal and whether we're in the right categories. Maybe on the 120-day deal, let us know what you think. And we don't have to have it all today. You can think about it and let Greg know. But
think fast, because I think this already went out to the RAC packet.
Way to go.
Never mind. We didn't get any feedback.
What would preclude someone from notifying you within 120 days? I mean, what
sometimes they're not aware that this is even an option. I don't think we're the only state in the West that's this liberal with these kinds of policies. Most states are and a couple of the states like Wyoming, they have a couple provisions for some categories of permit, like bighorn sheep. But you know, we're across the board, anything from a general deer tag to you know, everything to once in a lifetime. So a lot of people don't know, and they'll come back to our offices or they'll hear something, and a lot of times that they find out because of the 200 days is they'll go to apply in the next draw. So you got a hunt that ends at the end of October. Here comes our February application period, and at that point they'll call and say, you know, I got hurt last fall. Is there anything you can do? And we'll say, yeah, well, you know, go through this whole process that you're all familiar with, and we'll help you out. You know,
I got a question for you. With the once in a lifetimes, why would that not be in the season extension category? And the reason I ask that is if I put myself in for a desert sheep tag with, I think I got 5 points, just enough to keep me putting in, never enough to draw. Mm-hmm. And lightning strikes this year and I get a permit and something happens and I can't go and you give me my 5 bonus points back, I'm never going to draw that tag.
Well,
I am never going to draw that tag. You basically, here you go, here's your wooden nickels back.
Kind of back in the we're going to make you whole strategy, as though we're going to rewind the clock 10 months or whatever.
Well, if I'd already drawn the permit, well, I would think a once in a lifetime should have the option of a season extension. Because there's a pretty good chance you'd never get that again.
Yeah.
Even if you did get your bonus points.
I'll be honest, you're made whole
except for one thing. You're made whole on the bonus points, and it's not a waiting period. But we can't make you whole on your luck.
That's what I'm saying. My luck already found me. I have the permit. I've made it that far.
What we struggled with is, does luck deserve a season extension? And We pretty much decided no.
I would.
You can go back in the draw for the rest of your life and hope you draw it again.
Well, and I'd say with the rest of those, there'd be some light at the end of that tunnel with deer, elk, even a Henry's deer tag, with once in a lifetime.
This whole thing is
that's a
social. You know, we did science here when Anise was up. You're doing social now, so.
And that's why I'm saying I think that I would think once in a lifetimes would deserve the option of a season extension.
Let me just ask you this, and I'm not trying to be argumentative.
That's fine if you are.
Why any more than if on a limited entry San Juan elk tag? The elk tag's harder to draw than some of our sheep tags. So why not? I'm just trying to.
Well, I would say that you'll get that. I still think you're going to get the elk tag eventually in your life. I don't think you necessarily will get the sheep tag.
The odds are lower for.
I've looked at my odds in every situation, and I'm here to tell you my 5 points in the desert sheep pool mean nothing.
Yeah, they're not.
They mean nothing. They mean nothing.
What were you thinking?
I'm saying once I've drawn the tag, and catastrophic injury finds me before the hunt, I think you ought to get the tag next year for the once in a lifetime. That's my opinion. Feel free to disagree.
There's not a right or wrong here. We sat here for hours in meetings screaming about all this, just like you're. The one we probably spent more time screaming at each other on was convention and sportsman permits, which is you went in there and you do this, and the odds are 1 in 4,000 of drawing whatever you drew at the convention, and you get hurt, and it's sorry. You know, shouldn't have got hurt, you know, which has once in a lifetime in it as well.
I think John's led us into the area that's going to be most hotly contested in this thing and draw the most public input. I'd like to ask the question a slightly different way, though. Less interested in the guy with 5 bonus points who draws a desert bighorn. More interested in perhaps the situation of a 70-year-old or a 74-year-old who came down with cancer, horrible pains on the first day of his hunt, got hauled off, told he can go back out the next year. I've probably seen and listened to
20 of those of some sort in the last 12 years at the board meetings. Are you going to tell that guy that all he's going to get is his bonus points back? We've never disapproved one of those. Never.
There will be no board. There are every year terminal people in these categories who you will give their points back.
But I'm just saying no board has ever disapproved one.
Yeah.
So I don't know the answer, but I'm raising the question.
Well, and I that situation too. I mean,
it's all a matter of where you draw the line.
Is this something that we're voting on tomorrow?
No.
Well, it starts the RACs next Tuesday, so it's.
We just
wanted
to make
bat.
You aware of it so you can be thinking about
okay,
it.
Okay, I was looking at that. That's the bonus point rule that we're doing.
Greg, let me throw something out at you after what Ernie just said. Because I've had numerous people talk to me about it. And the older I get, the more plausible it sounds. At some point in time, age-wise, granddad, whatever reason, has the right to assign his points to immediate family member, son or grandson. And some of it, particularly if granddad's got cancer, we've seen that a couple times. Not something here, but it's something I'd like us to think about.
We've talked some about it. It's a code thing, is it? We need to run a bill. That's a legislative thing because of the way the code is. But we've talked about it, and several states do that. To the north, Idaho does it. The south, Arizona does it, where you can transfer those. But that is a Utah code thing that the board themselves couldn't address.
That's transfer of a permit, not transfer of points, right?
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you meant after they'd drawn it.
Transferring
no.
your points is a whole different...
We actually,
I took out transferring
was that one
points
of our
a few
options?
Years ago.
That was
yeah,
one
that
of
was
our
like,
options.
Got shot down. I think I got laughed off the stage in most of the state, or the RAC meetings. But,
I got, sorry, I didn't mean to cut
fine.
You off. I got another question for you.
Shot me down.
No.
If, if we took that little line out between, bonus point restoration and season extension, and still left all the general season antlerless, the swans, the cranes, and all that stuff out of there, we'd still be cutting our workload down a fair amount as compared to what we had this year, would we not?
Yeah. Probably.
Because after Ernie brings up his point.
Be cutting those out right there.
You'd have, on the right column, you'd have 48. Of your general season.
But look at the trend. I mean,
well, and
is,
I see that.
Your
another thing,
several
of the ones that we've dealt with have been with people that have been in the field a certain period of time. And you say 2 days. If I go out and shoot at an elk opening day and blow it and then break my leg the second day, you're telling...
You can't have harvested. It's one of the criteria.
What if you pulled the trigger and just flat missed? That's a pretty good opportunity.
As long as you didn't, yeah.
I don't like that either.
These are kind
I don't
of
like
numbers,
that either.
Know, and but you know, you've all struggled with this. We've sat up here the last, I don't know, two board meetings ago, and we probably had 8 or 9 people come in. And I think most of those had hunted. And one guy was rolled his ATV at last
they
minute.
14
and,
days.
You know,
but
I don't know, but you know. I don't know if it's a day. That's why Jim brought it up. Should it be a day? Should it be an hour? What?
Hasn't there been somewhat of a precedent set, though, that once you've hunted, you've hunted?
The board used to hold a hard line on that. Paul Niemeyer especially said, if you hunted at all, you're done. But then the board got more lenient and more people coming in, and over time, the board started drawing the line different places. And we started giving season extensions where they'd hunted 2, 3, 4 days. And so we got to reel that in.
See,
and maybe that's something you reel in more than the type of permit. I mean, there's lots of ways to go with this.
To me, that would be once you go out and you start hunting, what happens from that point on? That's part of your hunt. It may be a sad part, but that's part of your hunt. I didn't enjoy sitting here watching a guy's wife cry because we didn't give him his permit back. I did not like that. But once you've hunted and you're in the field, that's part of your hunt.
So where would you draw the line?
I'd draw the line. I would say one day. I'd say by noon opening day, you're hunting. Your camp's set up. You've glassed. You're hunting. If you pull the trigger and miss first thing opening day and break your leg, well, you had your chance and you blew it. Yeah. Not our fault you didn't.
You know, and then we have a little bit of discussion about, well, what kind of permit is it you actually had? You know, on a general season deer, you go, well, okay, you know, you hunted, if you had 10 minutes, you could have seen something, but if you didn't get it, you know, there's always another year. But if you're the guy with 19 sheep points or 19 elk points on the San Juan, you may not have planned to shoot that elk for 3 or 4 days till you looked at every elk you could find on the mountain. And so then you say, well, you should have shot the first bullet. I don't know. You know, this is
To me personally, I think 2 days is way plenty. I mean, a lot of good, a lot
of
bad
a hat.
Can happen.
A number
I
out
think
of a
that's
hat.
Way plenty. Once you've hunted, you've hunted.
Yeah, I'd go anywhere on the 1 hour to 1 day, personally.
Personally, and I'm with Ernie. Once you hunted, once you're out there, we can't control what happens to you on your hunt. Once you've got there, that's your hunt. If something happens and you can't get out in the field, and you don't have a chance to go in the field, a flash flood takes your horse trailer the day before. That I can agree with, but once you set up and you ride out into the field, you're hunting, and that's your experience. It may suck, but that's what you got.
Hey, John, I want to ask you a question. You talked about removing this line and treating these all the same. At what point, I don't know how to phrase this, at what point, you know, some of these limited entry big game tags are pretty easy to draw. Some are the same as a once in a lifetime. They're really hard to draw. Do you see a difference in these permits?
That's why I brought up the once in a lifetime.
I mean, or does anybody that deserve a season extension? No matter, I mean, some only take 2 or 3 bonus points.
Well, then that would be where I'd probably give them guys their bonus points back. If you got one that's going to take you 20 years to get and you already drew it and you didn't make it to the field to hunt because of, you know, the impending zombie apocalypse or whatever finds you, then you ought to get a season extension.
How does the rest of the board feel about that? Because we just agonized over this.
We had Stacy on the committee. She's part of it. Not that she has an opinion on anything, but, you know, you're welcome to chime in. Marty was on it, you know.
I'll chime in. I tend to agree with John on this once in a lifetime, man. It's, I'm only going to get one shot at that sheep, one chance at it. And I may be too old.
Yeah, and I'd chip in on that, too, and agree with Dell and say, okay, so I'm a limited entry guy with 16 points. I had a San Juan tag and I hunted for a day and broke my leg, to use a standard example here. I've always got the possibility of putting in for any other unit that I put in for, or almost any other unit, and having a tag the next year.
So what if we just moved once in a lifetime over to that third category?
I think so.
That's what I was.
I think so.
That applied to once in a lifetime people who drew a tag at the convention.
Well, you can still go back and put in for it again at the convention. I would say that would be the one where I would.
Yeah, you can with the other too.
If you give them their
bonus points back.
No.
No, I would leave convention permits out of it.
It's all the investment on that convention is not much of a deal.
Yeah,
that's not.
You're just rolling the dice, you know. You're not working for half your life.
So maybe move the once in a lifetime to the right, so I'm fine with. Because sure enough, I'll draw one of my once in a lifetime, break a leg. None of us know when this is going to pertain to us. That's the other thing.
What do you think about moving antlerless moose to the left?
I wouldn't have a problem with that either.
It's a bonus point species. It's going to have to stay in that column. Right. But.
Well, there you go. Never mind. Greg takes us both to the woodshed. The
bonus points away.
What do you say, no antlers moose permit whatsoever?
I got another question for you. What about, could there be a stipulation in there as far as bonus points that somebody had to draw a tag? Say there's a Henry Mountains deer tag that somebody's put in for. Like Ernie said, somebody's put in for 15, 16 years. They've drawn a Henry Mountains deer tag. They may not be around next year. Is there any way to put a stipulation if you've spent more than...
We can write anything we want.
10 or 12 bonus points to draw a tag that qualifies you for a possible season extension.
I think you're getting a little subjective if you start dividing up some limited entry here and some limited entry there based on bonus points.
That's what I'm asking, if that's possible or if that's just a mess.
This is Marty's
whole thing's
baby.
A mess.
Tell us, Marty.
Marty, is that a mess?
I'll give you an idea that I've never supported before.
Okay.
I have voted against many times and spoken against many times in conversations. But is a senior citizen difference?
Yeah, anybody over 60.
Not even sure 60 ought to qualify.
Well, I think so.
I'd say you have to be retired.
I hear what you're saying, Jim. But, is this one, the ones that we've always approved every time have been the guy that's more than 65 or something.
It's going to be a small group, a small number of your guys that apply anyway. I mean, you'd be dealing with a fairly small.
It is smaller.
However, that creates a privileged class, and now then you're going to have disabled people that want it, and you're going to have. So, I recognize the
doubts. Could we do that, Marty?
Yeah, we can. Write the rule however we want, as long as it's, you know, fair and equitable and we're not being arbitrary and capricious in where we draw our lines. But every category, every standard we set's a line we draw and say, if you're on the right side of the line, you're in, and if you're on the left side, you're not. If you got 15 bonus points, you get a season extension. If you got 14, you only get restoration of bonus points. And the only thing is the more we try to parse out these small details, the more complicated the rule gets, the more wordy it gets. You know, I'm always a big proponent in trying to keep it simple to the extent we can, and not always going to create the same level of detail, you know, that it may allow you a little more circumstances that are unanticipated. But ideally, what you have now, the authority you've got under the current rule gives you such broad authority, you can deal with anything pretty much how you want, but it comes with some bad consequences.
Comes with the heavy workload that we're trying to
get a lot of people that appeal. And the season extension, I think, and I believe everybody else agrees, is really the item that everybody wants. I think that's what's bringing so many people to the board is, you know, maybe they get injured and they could hunt, but not under ideal situation. They look at it and say, you know what, I think I'll wait till next year when I'm completely healthy. And you can get a doctor to write to say, yeah, it's probably not a good idea to go hunting. If that season extension wasn't available, I think we'll see a lot more people hunting as opposed to just getting their bonus points.
There's another important part, and it's not at the handout, and I think I'm going to change the handout before the first RAC meeting, which is this new rule also extends the same privilege to anybody who applied as a group. Any of the group members would have the same as any of the one party who's injured. So if there's four people drew, or two people drew limited entry bull elk, and one of them got hurt, the other guy could have the same relief as...
If not...
Why would you do that?
You say could or could not?
Could. Groups would be treated equally.
Why would you do that? Just so they can hunt together?
We did it mostly because we're getting a lot of people who said, we did this as a group and Uncle Louie got hurt and we don't want to drive clear to Utah without Uncle Louie. And so you've divided up our whole hunt opportunity this year.
So in other words, you're saying the group was precluded,
I think,
because the driver wasn't going.
Yeah. Don't we have one of those coming up, Stacy? We have one of those from somebody who's scattered from Texas to California, whatever. And they're like, I said, well, since our main guy got hurt.
Yeah.
But you've got to word it now that says, or a group
that makes
member.
Me go back.
Mm-hmm. No, yeah. Now it just says if you're in the group, not otherwise, hunting buddies, but applied in a group application, it could apply to everyone. We can take that out if we want as well.
See, now this makes me go back to my original thought that once in a lifetime would be the only one to slide over to season extension. Otherwise, you're just opening Pandora's box with all that, when you got the groups and everything involved. I mean, we could... Yeah, there's no groups with once in a lifetime.
Yeah.
That's true.
So let me ask this. Have we got time to... I'm hearing from the board there's two things we probably ought to change, 2 days to 1 day, and move once in a lifetime over to season extension before we take it to the public?
Well, we've certainly had lessons learned in the middle of RAC tours and softened up our position between RAC 1 and RAC 5. I think we could go out and mention some alternatives that we're very much willing to accept, like a one-day hunt or moving once in a lifetime over, and kind of let the RACs know that's something we're willing to consider. Because we've done that on RAC tours before. By the end, said, you know, all the other RACs kind of like this, and we don't mind it either. So if you want to recommend it, we like it.
If you want to ask the public whether they want a one-day or a 10-day there, they're going to take 10 by a 98-2. I don't know that I
think the public's going to be vastly confused about this whole rule, because you all know about it because you deal with it. These RACs don't have a clue about any of this.
Yeah, but we're talking your workload and our workload. I think.
Is it pretty consensus that it ought to be 1 day?
Boy, I just,
if that's a consensus, we at least ought to fix that.
Dale,
we can deal with the once in a lifetime after we get public input. But if the board has a consensus on that 1 day deal, let's do it.
Can I ask a question on that?
We had a member in here from the San Juan unit that hunted the first day, and he didn't take the bull because it wasn't big enough, and then he got hurt the second day. The way I remember that, and that would be a good example of that.
The way the rule's written right now is, or at least the proposed amendment, is if you spend any amount of time in a given day, that counts towards 1 day. So if you go hunt for 15 minutes 1 day, that's a full day. If you hunt the second day for 15 minutes, that's your 2 days. So you could actually only have 30 minutes of hunting and be excluded from getting a variance.
But that's your
fault. That's unlikely. Yeah. Now, what it leads me to is if we go to 1 day, are we going to have a period of time? Do they get 15 minutes, 1 hour, 2 hours, half a day? You know, do we want to get into that? Or if they sling their rifle over their shoulder or take their bow and they walk out in the field.
Hunting in a single day is considered a full day.
Yeah, I like the way John said it. You know, you get to your camping spot, load your gun, get walking out in the field, you're hunting.
Basically,
you're hunting.
Take the definition as we got it now, what it means to hunt.
Make it 1 day.
And 1 day.
Any part of 1 day.
I think we can change that. Did the RACs already have all this, Stacey? Are you getting it?
Oh, of course they do. She had it out by Christmas.
They said it was going out tomorrow. I thought you just said a minute ago they were going out tomorrow. Okay, we can still.
We can change. We've changed things at RACs before. That's not a big deal.
Put a notice on the web to contact Stacey with questions.
Proceed with caution.
I guess the other thing because this is going to be the tough one to swallow when something kicks in down the road, is limiting the board's authority. Maybe Marty this whole rule is really hard to read, or very legal. So do you want to address that, Marty, the limiting the board's authority and why that's different on other kinds of things they can do?
The rule is complicated because we're trying to draw a lot of lines, you know, and I say the more we try to draw more lines in it, we write more, and it inevitably gets more confusing. But the way it's written in the proposed amendment is the Wildlife Board is going to have limitations on its authority. The rule will still say you can grant a variance to anything, any way except if they file their petition for a variance 120 days after the end of the hunt, they're out, and the board can't consider that either. If they're not substantially precluded from hunting, in other words, if they hunt there one day, the board doesn't have an authority to grant a variance if they get hurt in the first 15 minutes. Season extensions. The limitations imposed on the division on the types of permits that get season extensions, conservation, once in a lifetime. The board is bound by that as well. The board cannot grant a season extension beyond 1 year, so into the next year. If they kill an animal, there's no authority to grant a variance, period.
If they were robbed by fate, as the guy said.
So those were some of the limitations we put, because if as long as the board has broad authority, we'll see the appeals coming. So the only way to try to slow them down is to limit the board's authority as well. But that's a two-edged sword, because there's going to be some sympathetic cases that are going to come through that you're going to want to do something. But if I effectively do my job and tie your hands, you won't be able to. So that's something to consider.
Marty, I have a question. We've had a couple of situations where people have come and said, we were getting ready to go hunting, and the Forest Service was closed because of the fire, so we weren't allowed in the area. So can I have a season extension? What about situations like that, if they've been precluded from going by the division or something else because of some forest fire or some such action?
Board cannot grant a season extension on any permits except the ones that are allowed.
What?
And this is the variance rule. This isn't everything you guys deal with. So these are the rules, unless I'm wrong, Marty. This is dealing with personal injury or illness to yourself or family member or military mobilization. So
or group, that's only the division.
Or group who has the same.
The board has authority to look at it all. The division can deal with injury, death, and mobilization in the military. Those are those three things. The board has authority to look at all the other circumstances that may arise that keep somebody from hunting. However, you can't grant a season extension except for the permits that are authorized.
You know, and still, as we talk about doing this, we are still far and away the most user-friendly state that I've ever, never have I seen another state that will do this. My good buddy that many of you in here know has been putting in Arizona for 14 years. He accidentally checked the wrong box and spent 14 points on a cow tag. And when he called him and says, there was a mistake, what can I do? They said, enjoy your cow hunt. 14 years worth of money and putting in, gone. They didn't even blink.
You granting that piece?
14 non-resident hunting licenses.
Yeah. So, I mean, when you put things in perspective, no matter what we do, I mean, we could really rein things in. We are still far and away the most user-friendly, compassionate state in the
And I think even with this rule, we still would
still
be.
Still are.
And we looked at all the states. Nobody would be as liberal as us, even if we pass everything you just talked about. So, not even close. Anyway, I it sounds like we've got some good feedback from you. Unless you've got some more, we'll make the couple changes. Move forward with the rack tour, I guess. We'll be back in 4 weeks talking about it again.
I think it's definitely a step in the right direction.
You know, I expect we could get some interesting things come out of the racks because they'd never heard any of these. Maybe some of the chairs have sat here through this. But most of the RAC doesn't even know we have a variance process. Most individuals don't know that we have, until they get into a situation. But I think if we don't do something, and you saw the graph, more people are going to learn over time. We're pretty good at training our public. And I think we could turn 156 of these into the thousands when you have general season in there, and we don't want to go there. And it does take a lot of time to go through all these medical records and everything else we've got to do. So. I'll do at least the first three nights, and if it's troublesome, I'll do all five of them. If it's a piece of cake, I might hand off a couple. We'll see.
Can I ask Marty and the chairman a question considering RACs? A couple times I've been at a RAC just observing, and they've asked me questions. What was the board? Why did the board do this, or what was the board asking there? What do you do? Just duck out in the back and pretend like you're not there. I'm not really comfortable speaking for the board.
Well, the minutes are the official response to why you did something different than a RAC recommendation.
But I mean, if they're like on the deer thing, when we go through and they say, well, why did the board ask to look at 15 to 17 as opposed to 18 to 25? And, I mean, I'm not...
Jim may disagree. I mean, I don't think you want to look like you're hiding any information or trying to obstruct the flow of information. I think I'd be careful to qualify your statement saying, I'm not speaking for the board. This is my understanding. This is how I understood it. But check the minutes. They'll give
my
you
personal opinion. You'd want to qualify your statement. Not
so that you're not speaking for the board. If you want to comment, I think in the past have asked, you know, board members to be cautious about just getting up and commenting in RAC meetings. But if you ask a specific question about an action of the board that's occurred previously, I think it's okay to respond. Just make sure they understand.
That it's your opinion and your personal understanding.
They want the official, you know, the...
With
that being said, I mean, if they're asking about a matter that hasn't come to the board yet, that I would be real careful. Because what you don't want to do is give any impression that you've predetermined.
Both times it's been concerning a vote in the past, and to clarify.
I was have been asked to, when I attend the RAC meetings, to just talk a little bit about the last board meeting. Is that something you would discourage, or is that okay, or what's the approach?
Legally, that's fine. I don't, you know, Jim can respond as, you know, from a matter of policy.
Usually they'll do that. They'll say, you know, give us a report on the last board meeting.
Chair of responsibility.
Just remind them the official record. Read the minutes of what we did.
This is what I understood.
Yeah, what Ernie just said is what I've seen. RAC chair. He reports to his RAC members what the board did the previous session. That's how it's supposed to work.
I mean, I'm happy for that to be the case. I just assume not make the report, but I have done it once, and I was not at the last meeting, so I didn't make a report. But I'm going to be there next Wednesday night, and if I don't have to make a report, or if I shouldn't be making a report, then I just assume not.
Was that because the chair wasn't?
No, that was because the chair asked me if I would.
Normally the chair gives that report.
Yeah.
That's the chair's responsibility, mine, and I personally have tried to just keep quiet.
Okay, well, I'll talk to Darius tomorrow.
I also think a good chair ought to be putting out something right after the board meeting in an email to his RAC members. Waiting a month to 2 months to get a report on what the board did on the meeting that you were really excited about doesn't seem appropriate to me. So I know some of the chairs are doing that. All it takes is a short email.
Well, defend yourself. And how quick are the minutes posted?
It's a whole month after, but here's a list of the...
Oh, well, that's what I meant, the audio.
The audio is posted.
I reemphasize one thing. If you're asked to express an opinion that's currently before the RAC and hasn't come to the board, that's where I'd be real careful.
Basically, if they do that, they're basically asking you how you're going
to
vote.
They are. And that's why I think that's inappropriate to basically be expressing your position before you've heard all the public comment.
I like to hide my opinion anyway. So.
That's good.
Well, in reality, that's what we should do, even though I may have a preconceived notion of what to do. Can't really formulate it until you hear both sides of the equation.
Thank you, Marty.
Okay, are we done? Thank you, folks. We'll see you early tomorrow morning. Yeah. Thank you.